Behold, it's another episode of the Gaming Memories Podcast, where I, the prophet, he who hath been anointed by the gaming gods themselves, even Miyamoto, the father, Kojima, the son, and Carmack, the motherfucking Holy Ghost, told me to create the one true gaming podcast. I simply need to interview creative and interesting people about their favorite gaming memories growing up. And today, we're doing exactly that. Surprise, surprise, I'm actually doing what I would say I would do. Whew, you'd think I'd do that more often, but shit happens. Today's guest, we are introducing the femme fatale, the gothic goddess grappling with grisly horror games and grandiose existentialist philosophy on Twitch, Gray as Dust. Gray as Dust is a Twitch streamer who plays primarily horror games, has like really cool, I don't know if it's cosplay, because I don't think she's cosplaying anyone specifically, but like gothic, like crazy gothic style. I don't know if gothic is the right term, forgive me if that is incorrect, but it's where some subset of gothic, but she dresses up in really cool outfits, swapping out her like contacts and makeup, talks about vampires, horror games, existentialism, philosophy. She's very, very well educated, becoming even more educated as we speak. She's an extremely intelligent person, and she mixes horror games and philosophy and everything in between. And I found that very interesting. I ran across her on Instagram first, and then started checking out some of her VODs, VODs, which I believe, I'm so behind the times, is the kids use this term as like recorded past streams. I'm not exactly sure if that's the case, but I watched some of her past streams, got a sense for what she's about, and found her to be more than interesting. So, brought her on the podcast, and we chatted, had a grand old time. All of her applicable links will be in the podcast description. As usual, please go and support her. Twitch, Instagram, what's the other one? X, Threads, TikTok, yada, yada, yada. She's doing all the things, playing all the games, very entertaining, has a cool community. I think she's planning on launching a Discord community or already has. Memory does not serve perfectly, but something like that is either in the works or soon to be launched. So if that is the case, I would also recommend supporting her in that regard. Which brings me to my next point, is how to give me money. If you'd like to directly support the podcast because you're a fucking idiot and you got money to blow, or you understand paying tithing will bring you blessings from the gods, you can head over to patreon.com gaming_memories, or click the link in my link tree and throw your money away for worthless things like a shout out on my emulation Bible spreadsheet, an invitation to a private Discord, access to my upcoming tutorial content, outtakes, B-rolls, cut content from episodes, and then even early content that will come out on Patreon before it comes out to the rest of the public. I'm not claiming anything in this is actually worth your money. You should not go into it thinking it is worth your money, because it probably isn't. I would rather you think of it as like, hey, I like this content. I might want to throw them a bone or two and maybe get some extra shit out of it. That's how I think about it. I am currently building out the Patreon to be worth the money, but it is a work in progress. But if you want to give me your money anyway, I'm not going to say no, but I'm not going to tell you should do it either, because you can simply like, share, and comment, share the good news of the gaming gospel, and ye shall be blessed. Thus saith the gods, even Miyamoto, Father, Kojima, the son, and Carmack, the Holy Ghost. I say these things in their name. Amen, and enjoy the show. Oh, there it is. There's the cup. I bought that exact same cup from Etsy for my brother as a Christmas gift.
They have like full size now. It's supposed to be like life sized, and then they also have steins. I was like, I just want the original.
Is your chair have like bolts or fabric? What is it?
It's upholstered. Yeah, I actually picked this up on the side of the road.
Oh, nice.
My apartment is mostly like a gym and computers. I didn't have a place to actually sit because I have a treadmill and like a hydraulic disk set up.
But I did notice on one of your streams, you just like walk on the treadmill and talk to people.
Yeah. It's, I wouldn't say I'm like a variety streamer, but I've incorporated a lot of like sort of non-gaming themes alongside. So it's kind of a perfect splice between two things.
I want to know what BC Rich is in your background. That big bag?
It's a coffin case, actually.
Yes.
It's a warlock base, which most of the time I get a lot of shit for that. I get a lot of shit for just carrying it around, but I got it in like 2010. Somebody was trying to like pawn it, and they said that they didn't get enough money for it, so they sold it to me instead. And I was like, I don't care. I want to be able to hold one. The funny thing is,
warlock,
I haven't used enough. It's a, yeah, it's, did what you want me mean? To open it?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Okay. Okay. It's a bass guitar. It's a electric bass. The inlining is like red velvet, super goth.
Oh, damn. That is like a legit. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's quite dark in here, but this.
Now it makes sense. It's for it's for your bass. I thought I was like, it looked too small to be like an actual case. And when you said warlock,
coffin, yeah.
And you said warlock, I was like, does she mean like warlock the instrument or warlock like a wizard male druid dude?
I keep them in boxes. I keep my men in boxes.
So you're a bass player?
I can't say that I'm a musician, unfortunately. I would like to. I am a music enthusiast. But when it comes to sort of like my musical development and my musical talents, I was more of a singer. I did vocals and I never really took myself seriously, but I wanted the equipment around me so that in case I did pick it up and had time, that I would be able to eventually form my own accompaniment by, you know, using pedal boards. And I love Earthquaker. So most of the time I just like to make noise. I've used it for kind of non-practical guitar use where you can make frequencies that sound spooky and, kind of get lost in reverb and echo and kind of have that drowning effect. I wouldn't necessarily call it shoegaze, but I used to have a ton of, musician friends, right? And I always sang, but when it came to like stage performance, I was always nervous, especially around singing for some reason, even though like I sang all the time and I was section leader in choir and like I did theater and stuff. It was just like whenever it had a lot of weight, whenever I really wanted to express myself is when I kind of strayed away from it, which is ironic. So yeah, I started identifying with kind of just weirder music, dissonance, things that didn't necessarily make sense in that perfectly like classical way. And so, yeah, I started kind of collecting equipment where there is some synth stuff back there too. My friend just gifted me this to borrow. And you can plug a bunch of stuff into it.
Nice.
And
just a solid piece of kit.
There's pedals for Silent Hill sounding stuff. It's called the Afterneath by Earthquaker.
I know Earthquaker, but I don't know if I'm familiar with that. I'm kind of a pedal nut, so I feel.
I know.
I should know that one.
The Afterneath.
I love that name, Earthquaker.
It's got all kinds of stuff, but I mean, think of like casting spells in a cave and getting lost in that echo and that resonance. I don't know. So, I put together this giant cable rig to try to take a condenser mic and plug it in to this. And then actually produce sound on the other side. And I was like, I realized that I needed a dynamic mic, but to create vocals through a guitar pedal. Some of the genius of the vocalists that I enjoy the most have done that, where they kind of have that spooky, ethereal addition to their vocal strengths. It's something that I've been trying to dabble in. And, you know, I haven't necessarily been in like the right environments to have that sort of creativity flow. Because, you know, it's kind of like if you get caught up in bigger cities or scenes or, you know, if you are actually like friends with musicians and you're a musician yourself, you can get caught up in sort of that talent sharing that just comes naturally with hanging out, right? You want to be together and you want to be in that space together and you want to make stuff. And that stuff happens to be resonance and music. And I was sometimes in those spaces and I was sometimes lucky to be around those people to learn a little bit at a time. But I was also like very reclusive and I spent a lot of time kind of pushing my throat, like pushing myself through college as best I could with like lots of part-time jobs and you know, video games. So balancing my time with trying to like create that strong musical muscle, the only thing that I feel truly strong and competent in is my voice. But the problem is that I have stage fright. So in terms of confidence and like actual performance, like on a stage, probably not, but eventually trying to record something that I make myself with the frequencies that I make myself, inspired by the people who made me want to do those things. You know, the music that I get totally just hyper fixated on all the time. This is probably the reason why I'm here.
You should definitely scratch that itch at some point.
Right. I want to create spooky stuff.
I like this. I'm looking at this. So I love moving sound through real circuits. My brother's, who I do music with, is like way into modular, and I'm really into pedals. He's into pedals too. Mm-hmm. But this, I love reverb pedals. I use a pedal called the Empress Reverb a lot, and I love distortion.
Empress
Reverb is it's the reverb I've been using. But my brother just got a new reverb pedal, and it wasn't this one, but I loved, and I was actually thinking like, man, I want something a little darker than the Empress. And I'm also like a branding nerd. I love branding and marketing. Mm-hmm. And I love the name Afterneath. I love the artwork on it, the wizard.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It's just like, okay, that's half the fun of pedals. It's just like, mm-hmm. For me, obviously, number
the
one,
design.
Sounds. But number two is it sexy? Does it look cool?
Oh, yeah. It's like, what's in the box?
Yeah. Who are some of the vocalists that you like?
I wrote this down because I was like, man. Chelsea Wolfe is a big one.
Okay.
Chelsea Wolfe is huge. And, you know, she has kind of this knack for kind of stepping out of each genre from the album before. And she can, and her genre range is incredible. It can be anywhere from, you know, kind of that dark acoustic to doom to industrial to metal. So, you know, she never really sticks with one, and tries to sort of push herself into almost every category. And she's even done some like ASMR stuff too. So it's just fascinating, that some musicians just never really do the one trick pony thing. They're actually trying to create new things and see where, you know, where they feel like they might have limits, they can step past them in a musical sense or passing into another medium while you're a musician. Who else? Public Memory. If you're familiar.
I'm not familiar with that. Give me a rundown.
Public Memory is,
Memory Band. Is that
the band? The band, yeah. Unfortunately, I'm really bad with names and numbers.
According to the old interwebs, which, you know, you never know. According to Pitchfork, Public Memory is the solo project of Robert Tower, a Brooklyn-based musician who formerly served time as a member of Eris and Apsy, both I'm not familiar with. Mm-hmm. While those projects blurred the edges of rambling space rock, Public Memory dives headlong down the electronic dark wave. I like that.
Hey.
Exploring chord construction.
I suppose that's appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, dark wave's a term I use for our music sometimes. It's like, mm-hmm. The problem with music, and I think video games are kind of getting there as the barrier to entry to develop video games, and you have more indie games sort of blurring the lines between styles, is... It's important to have labels because they're practical. So like you and I can talk and get on the same page about like what kind of music we're referring to.
Oh, yeah.
But everybody also categorizes everything sort of differently, their own way internally. Like I know I have my own genre labeling system that not everybody would agree with. But you have to make sense of it in your head. Mm-hmm. And I use the term dark wave for our music, but I don't, but then I listen to other dark wave music and I'm like, maybe that's not the best label because I'm not quite like this or that, but dark wave is like the closest term I've found. So the fact that they're calling this guy Public Memory, which I love that name, dark wave. I'm going to have to check this out.
Very good. Very good. Very good vibes. Especially with a genre that I'm probably going to lay mention to. I love, Disfig, D-I-S space F-I-G. I want to say that, like, she seems more new to me, very, very nuanced. But she was a feature in an album that is slowly releasing itself with a band collection of, I think, two people called The Body.
Okay.
And if you're familiar with them, very, very dissonant, very, very avant-garde, if you ask me, in terms of what people would consider music and what people would consider noise. And it's kind of this drony, discomforting, abject version of music that still holds beauty inside of it. And so The Body typically features a very, very high-pitched screaming male vocal, very, very high tenor. And it's very uncomfortable and retching almost, but it's also accompanied by beautifully singing female voices. I think that they've had a couple of other people kind of join in to collaborate as well. I just don't know the names of them, but the album that's coming out with Disfig is so good. It hit me so hard. I've just been listening to it over and over again. Also Funerals with a V, F-V-N-E-R-A-L-S. And even King Woman, if you're familiar with King Woman and Health. I can just keep going.
Yeah, I mean, so...
so the like vibes.
I'm like an old school music head. I have a hard time... This, well, first off, Funeral's branding is fucking sick.
Mm-hmm.
And then Health is legendary. Like, they did... I remember when they did the Max Payne 3 soundtrack. I was so pumped. Because it was just cool to see them in a video game. But I like them in also Disfig and The Body's... The Body, when I look at the two dudes that are coming up in the pictures, then I'm like, yeah, these guys make like some kind of doom ambient metal for sure.
Yeah, you could call it that. You could call it that. You could call it, oh man. Have you ever heard of agoraphobic nosebleed? No. It's just like, it's like discomfort, but for some reason you stay. And like, if you get through it, there's like beauty at the end of it. It's
not
for the faint of heart.
I mean, I make dark music, but I try at the end. There's like a ray of hope inside of it. That's kind of like the idea. But I also like dark aesthetic, and it just is what it is.
Absolutely. I bask in it. I bask in it every day of my life.
Speaking of, I know you were talking about Silent Hill earlier. I just sent you an image in the chat. So.
Oh, here we go.
That is a sigil that I designed, but do you recognize the inspiration for this?
Oh, absolutely. Very nice. The three circles, especially. Well, technically it's five circles, but.
Well, so yeah, I took the Halo of the Sun sigil from, I think that first was shown in Silent Hill 3.
I want to say it was blatantly in Silent Hill 3. I don't know if it was subliminally somewhere hidden in Silent Hill 2, but I don't believe so.
Yeah, I know it was in
Downpour also.
Yes. So I took that and then I swapped out the center part where they have like a bunch of stuff. The upside down triangle and the three circles is like our own sort of like, fan fiction religion.
Oh, yeah.
That we're creating.
And I
changed some of the stuff on, but I wanted it to be like, I wanted a Silent Hill fan to be like, I can tell where that came from, but it's also different enough where it's our own thing. So I'm hoping.
I definitely respect it. Definitely respect it and can appreciate where it came from. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm actually test printed it. This is our new merch on the back.
Oh, I'm going to pick it up as soon as it's available.
We'll definitely do it at some point. We're trying to launch. We only put out two songs last year and we were kind of really bummed about that. We have four coming out this month with an EP and then.
Yeah,
we're trying to. You know,
congratulations.
It's hard. Music is hard. Writing is easy. Finishing songs is very difficult.
I feel like music is difficult. Like music can be made easy if you're not trying. But like when you're trying and you want to put passion and business together, like that part is hard. That part's like, oh man, like it's going to either like dishearten me or maybe it'll fill me with like a temporary joy, but I'm going to be really stressed in the middle of it. Like, you know, and then is it a part of the project or is it just like something that I'm just trying to do to get by? Like those two things are very, very different. But when it's a passion, right? Like you make it work.
Yeah. And for those, I forgot to realize some people aren't going to be watching, for those just listening in Silent Hill 3, they introduced a sigil that is representative that represents like the original. There's so, in Silent Hill 1, there's like a cult you get introduced to. Mm-hmm. You worship. It's a long story, but it's a it's an old game. So spoiler alert, if you haven't played it, you should definitely play it. But it's also like a 30-year-old game, so I don't feel bad if I spoil you. But there's a cult trying to like use this little girl who's special, like a split soul, and resurrect this demon god. And then they kind of, Silent Hill 2 is its own standalone story, pretty much with loose connections. And then Silent Hill 3 is almost like a direct sequel to Silent Hill 1. And they introduce a sigil that this cult uses called the Halo of the Sun, right? Or something like
Halo,
that?
Halo of the Sun, I want to say.
A Halo of the Sun. Anyway, I took that sigil and like retconned it and turned it into like something slightly different. So that's what we're talking about. If you're curious, you could just look up Silent Hill, Halo of the Sun. The Silent Hill games have really, really cool lore, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about them as we move forward. Yeah. Very stoked for, well, I don't know how, are you pumped for the Silent Hill 2 remake, or are you feeling like?
I am so pumped. I might be like, you know, a little bit like overhyping it in my own mind. But genuinely, sort of the way that I started up on Twitch was the passion for horror games, and not just horror because it's scary and not because, you know, there's scare factors and blood everywhere. It was more about sort of the puzzle and the life experience of sort of going through real challenges, difficult challenges, emotional challenges, getting a story that was very intimate and very thick. When I actually began, it was right in October of 2023. So I'm fairly recent. I'm still emerging. But I was planning on actually going back and through emulation, going to start with Silent Hill and Silent Hill 2 and Silent Hill 3 and go in order to try to finish them by the new release. I just sort of ran into some issues with trying to make high quality emulators work.
I happen to know a guy that could maybe.
hey there.
You could definitely, you know, Silent Hill 1 and 2 are not hard to get like a really solid experience. Silent Hill 2, actually, there's what's called the Enhanced Edition. So there was a Silent Hill 2 port that was for PC that was just god awful. Mm-hmm. But because Silent Hill has such a rabid fan base, they've created what is like an unofficial remaster of the PC port. It's called Silent Hill Enhanced Edition.
It's super, I did look at that, but I was.
All you have to do is you have your regular Silent Hill, like, PC version, which is abandonware now, so you can just get it off like an abandonware site. You can't even buy it, but you can go get it super easy.
Okay.
And then all you do is download Silent Hill Enhanced Edition and tell it to install like where your Silent Hill game is, and that's it. One click install, boom, everything in the options menu. It's like you don't have to know any really hardcore technical stuff to play that version of the game.
Oh yeah.
I would recommend that. And both in Silent Hill 1 emulation wise, if you grab Duck Station, I can get you set up in like 15 minutes. It's super easy.
Oh, hey, that's awesome. That's really, truly awesome. Cause
and I think
going
you
back
do it.
To those retro games, it's like, obviously there's a lot of stuff coming out on Steam. And some of them are kind of like ripoffs, and some of them are like, you know, not necessarily renditions. They're their own story, but they pay homage to Silent Hill and Resident Evil and, you know, the franchises that kind of defined what horror game metrics were supposed to kind of like the quota, right, of what you were supposed to include and what was scary and what was jarring to people, but what was also very addictive and very easy to connect with. But yeah, I wanted to start with that. So cool that I'm, you know, would have the potential to actually going back.
When does it come out?
Games.
The remake's supposed to come out.
It's 2024. I'm just not necessarily sure if they're going to push it back at all.
It just says 2024.
Yeah, because it's gonna come out for PlayStation 5 exclusive first, I think, and then it's gonna come out for PC. But I'm not necessarily sure on the timing of that.
Exclusive for PS5 at launch before being eligible to release on other platforms following 1 year. Okay. Well, I think you probably have time. I mean, you can beat Silent Hill 1 and 2 in like, I mean, if you have a guide.
A sitting. Just do like a 12-hour stream.
You could probably
go for it.
I've seen some, like, you know, those long plays where someone's really good at the game. They get through the game pretty fast, but yeah, you could definitely do it. So before we get into like your gaming growing up. Let people, I know we'll have an intro before this starts, but give people in your own words a little background of who you are, how you got into streaming, what your Twitch channel is about. I know you just started, but you're already an affiliate, right?
I am.
So that's so good.
So yeah, my I go by Gray. My username is Gray as Dust pretty much everywhere. It's GreyasDust. I basically kind of fell in by accident and mistake to a group of people who had been already streaming. And I was a guest on a stream. I just kind of added myself into a Discord server where these people just kind of adopted me. I became sort of anonymous, and I moved to a different city. I had finished college, and I was sort of in a little bit of a crisis where I was like, I don't know what I want to do. I need to sort of look into myself again and reevaluate, you know, do I want community or do I want to be alone? Do I want to pursue my PhD in philosophy and in English rhetoric? It would be an interdisciplinary major. And do I want to try to seek that out? Or do I want to try to find something lucrative? And I'd always been gaming. I'd been gaming my entire life, and we'll get to my background, but I had taken a very, very long hiatus from video games, you know, trying to tell myself, and the people around me were reinforcing the fact that video games were immature and that it was a part of my life that I had to let go of, and that I had to mature beyond and create a career for myself and make myself this person that
I don't know who you're talking about, but they're full of shit.
It seemed very ambiguous to me to be like, I don't even know what you're saying to me. Like, you know, somebody in my life, the person that I was in a relationship with, they just wanted me to be sort of the wife, and I felt very boxed in, and like I wasn't supposed to be there, that I had a purpose to be alone, to be on my own, to be self-sufficient, to be a performer to some degree, because I was creatively starved. And I felt empty. I didn't have video games anymore. I didn't have media. I was pretty much off grid. And spending most of my days, like, taking care of animals and working out, you know, bettering myself and preparing myself for some greatness. I don't know. some greatness in the void that I was supposed to manifest, right? But yeah, no, it kind of all crashed and burned, and I left my relationship because it wasn't making me happy. And I discovered community in the Discord server that I was in. They welcomed me, and they were streamers. So that's what they did, was they socially started up on Twitch. One of my closest friends, Maisie Lenny, she's big on TikTok and also very big on Twitch as well. She's Twitch partner. And I had kind of become a recurring disembodied voice in the games that I would accompany her in. We would play Dead by Daylight and Sea of Thieves. And so it turned from my youth being a console gamer, having almost every console, even doing MMORPGs. 2018, I got my desktop built for me, and I knew that I had the capacity to be able to use Steam again. And I was like, you know, communal gaming, heck yeah, let's go. Yeah. And then we fell into probably like, I want to say like 5 months of Baldur's Gate 3. And then I launched in October, and I wanted a theme for horror games. I wanted appreciation for a little bit more down tempo, because my friends are hilarious and they're great entertainers. They're unhinged and chaotic and charismatic and very just left and right. There's actors, there's voice actors, there's D&D gamers, lots of Dungeons and Dragons themes. Coming from that content creation that they do on TikTok. And I just have sort of got like a whirlwind of becoming alive again on social media platforms, and sort of doing my own content, and sort of just expressing myself slowly and trying to sort of reemerge and rediscover, who I was and how I wanted to express myself and how I wanted to exude a certain mood that people could identify with, that a lot of people tended to reject in younger stages of my life. Something that I thought, you know, it doesn't hurt to feel like visceral, like viscerally in depth with something, to be intimate with something, and especially with like topics and passions and things that people enjoy. And a lot of that stuff comes from the eras of like Gothic romanticism. So you might not be able to see, and I don't necessarily try to use this as a gimmick, but I have permanent fangs.
I was wondering if it was like a retainer.
They're dental fillings. They're surface fillings, but I've had them since 2016. So they're genuine enamel. And they're permanent. They don't go away. And so I'm the resident vampire of my social media community.
Nice.
And so that we created a theme that, adjacent to the horror games that I have chosen to play, whether they be Resident Evil 5, Resident Evil 8, for sure. We went through all of Resident Evil 8. But adjacent, right, I had brought them excerpt readings from Joseph Sheridan LaFanu's Carmilla, which is a vampire story that predates Dracula by 20 years. And so just kind of bringing them sort of snippets of Gothic literature alongside also my other major, which is philosophy. I studied phenomenology for a very long time, which is a subsection of existentialism, and existentialism is sort of a German-French era philosophy circa around World War I-ish Europe, sort of reevaluating what it is to be human and how experience and existence is observed through perception, and reevaluating it and not explaining it away with science and ontology and things that are known and things that are learned as opposed to experience. And you can apply a lot of that to horror games. So a lot of those discussions kind of gear towards different existentialism topics. And so we have all kinds of stuff.
I'm trying to think of where to take this. Just, we have a lot in common, and I know you listen to some episodes, so I can go like 4 hours. I don't know how long. Episodes can be long, and I could tell we could definitely go 4 hours. But there's a few things I want to hit on. Number one, I think I'm like a marketing and branding nerd. I think what turned me on to you when I first came across you, because we connected over similar musical tastes, and I'm into like pretty underground music. So obviously,
the fact that I found it, I was I want to mention, because yes, I did listen. I've been listening to episodes of the podcast, and Snakes of Russia.
He's like the godfather, in my opinion. He's the bomb.
Right. I was like, oh my gosh, what an honor. And then on top of that, also Black Moth as well.
I feel like Black Moth would get very much along.
I would say that the two of them also mentioned Lorne, and I was like, this is it. Like, yeah. Lorne seems to be like the paradigm shift for certain things and certain inspirations.
Yeah. Lorne is one of those artists, if I say like, hey, are you familiar with Lorne? People either say no or their eyes light up. Because if you have found Lorne, you have found the truth. Mm-hmm. When it comes to, like, I mean, my entire music, I grew up playing metal bands. My previous project was like, it was video game based. It was called RoboClick. It was very like happy video game. I was making music for like indie games and video game remixes. It was very like traditional pixel, happy, bit crushed, whatever. And I was, but I had always grown up listening to metal. Tool was my favorite like prog band growing up.
Tool, yeah. And Radiohead.
Yeah. And Smells. Definitely like watershed moments for me. I was really into Primus as a kid.
Listen to Primus.
You run across Mr. Bungle back in the day. He's pretty obscure.
I don't think Mr. Bungle is something that I caught, but I was like proud of Primus. I was like, yeah,
he's a when were you born, right? By chance, if you don't mind me asking?
Circa 1992.
Okay. So yeah, Mr. Bungle was kind of old when I was born in 85, and he was kind of old then. So it doesn't surprise me. But you might find some interest in him. Very avant-garde, like kind of all over the map. You never know what he's going to do. He plays vacuums on one of his albums.
Like field recordings. And yes. Then you use them as sounds.
Weird stuff. But anyway, so I found, and then I discovered Lorne when Ask the Dusk, I think that album came out.
Okay.
And I immediately called my brother and I was like, bro, whatever you're doing, go down to your studio right now and turn this fucking song on right now. Mm. And since that day, my entire like musical trajectory has changed. He completely changed my life. I just became a super fan overnight. It was like someone.
Lorne hit me like a nuke. It hit me so hard the first time. Yes. And I had to play it again. And I'm that type of person. I'm like a borderline autistic. I'm to the point where like when I fixate on a song and it catches me, I will have to actually put that song on repeat for like a minimum of like an hour. No. So I can just soak it all in.
We are the same.
Like albums, yes, but like if it's a single, like I'm going to listen to that single fucking day.
There's a song called, when I was in college, I got a degree. It's worthless, like they all are, in my opinion, for the most part.
Listen. I have a double major and a minor. It's 8 years of college, and then I'm working healthcare. So
anyway, my whole family. I've never been diagnosed, but my whole family thinks I have Asperger's. So mm-hmm. I could probably relate. There's a song mm-hmm. called "Marble House" by a group called The Knife. And I remember for some reason that song.
I know The Knife.
Yeah. It's not one of their most popular songs. My Mother's Health or something is their most popular song. But they have a song called Marble House. And for some reason that.
I know that song.
That song.
I know that song.
Was my song for a year. And my roommates wanted to murder me because I had giant.
Oh my gosh.
In my room. And I would draw for hours with that song on repeat. And I remember one time my roommate Brant. If you ever listen to this, Brant, you're a badass. Brant comes in. He's like, I'm going to fucking kill myself. Turn that song off. I can't do it anymore. And I'm just like, yeah. I get it. Fair enough. Yeah. It's been like 6 days of this song nonstop. Like
my roommates with Chelsea Wolf, it would be like, I think I scoped it out to maybe like six of her albums, but the six albums would be on repeat shuffle. Yeah. And so like, if you heard me coming, it was most likely, or if you heard me like coming from my room, there would just be this constant oohs and ahs and howling because like she never stopped playing like ever. But yeah, so public memory was like that. Lorne was like that. Forest Swords.
Oh, I do know Forest.
Please not tell me. Okay. Yeah. Like, it's very dissonant, right? Very dissonant. Mm-hmm. And then Soft Moon and Health. Yeah. Like, I don't know. They were good, but Marble House is good too.
I wouldn't say there's so many.
I'm
a super fan, but I also will fixate on, there's certain groups where they have like three or four songs and it's just those couple songs. And I don't know any other music because it's just like, well, you'll never make Marble House again. And that song is awesome for whatever reason. But what I was trying to
get at. I heard someone mention Bjork and I was like, yeah.
Yeah, Bjork. I mean, God damn. Yoga by Bjork, J-O-G-A, that mm-hmm. song in particular. Mm-hmm. So I have a Spotify playlist called Creme de la Creme. It's just like those songs that make me want to fixate. And Bjork has like a couple. Army of Me is one of them.
Army of Me, yep, that's the one. There's good. So many remixes of that one.
Yeah, that's definitely, I think, her most popular song, at least to my memory. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to say back to what I was saying about your branding, I'm very interested in people who are extreme personalities and they just lean into their uniqueness. The more I've done that in my life, the better my life has gotten. I mean, this whole podcast mm-hmm. blew up when I stopped trying to be kind of like what I thought a gaming content creator should be and more of like, well, what do I actually genuinely do? I spend all day fucking with emulators. That's what I do. So I'm going to start like making my content that's genuinely like, I don't really follow I follow mainstream news, but that's not what I'm excited on. Like, hey, there's this new Doom ROM hack where you can play as Sonic or whatever. I'm interested in like the weird shit the community's doing. So I just started covering that and talking about that more. And I think it resonated with people because you were I was genuinely being myself and people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They can pick it up. Yeah, yeah. Oh, they can pick it up. I have noticed that people really feel like it's a breath of fresh air to know, you know, instead of trying to be funny or trying to be sexy or trying to be anything other than what I am, I'm a little bit of sultry, a little bit of spooky, and pretty deep in terms of just wanting to be able to talk about existence.
You also have permanent fangs, so you're not playing
around. I also have permanent. I'm not fucking around. I'm not a poser. I'm not a temporary cosplayer. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. So I picked up when we connected over some music stuff. I checked out your profile and I'm like, this person is going all in. That interests me, right? Even if they have like completely opposing, like not opposing, but I would say like interests that I don't overlap with. Like even if we didn't overlap on music or video games, I would still be interested. I'm interested in anyone who has like an extreme personality and they're just kind of going down their own rabbit hole. Because you can, I just find, I don't know,
The way that you coined the term extreme personality, but like in a positive, it's not a,
you're not afraid to go all in to whatever you're,
it's, you know, a benign definition. Yeah.
It's, I mean, maybe extreme can have a negative connotation. So maybe it's not the perfect label and mm-hmm. I might come up with a better term.
It stands out. It's but not in a cliche way. So extreme is just like, well, it's obviously the opposite of what normality would look like. You know, you like what the typical, right? It's against the typical. So extreme is just its opposite.
And I think there's a lot of really, like, I would consider myself maybe not on the surface. I don't look as extreme as I am. But like, I also have like a regular job, a wife, a kids. Like, I'm a normal functioning person mm-hmm. in society. And then I think people, you know, most people in my life have no idea about the podcast. They have no idea about the music projects. They have no idea who I'm ghost producing and making music for, or that I might be gone on a weekend playing a show here or that. And it's like, I like that a little bit, like the mystery, but I also know that there's a lot of other people out there like me who are really interesting. You just wouldn't know, because I grew up in, and I think part of the reason why I'm interested in, I grew up in like a hardcore cult, I grew up in like hard, I don't know how much you know about Mormonism, but like
hardcore. My friend was an ex-Mormon.
Okay. So
I have heard horror stories.
I mean, it's not all bad. And I have a lot of friends and family who are still Mormon, and some of them listen to the podcast and it works for them. That's great. It can work for some people, but it did not work for me. And it took a long time to sort of sort through that, which is probably why I'm attracted to exploring themes of religion and death and spirituality.
Oh, yeah.
Probably to come to terms with all that. But I also mm-hmm. grew up being like, Mormonism has a very narrow view of what success and, quote, a good person is.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're talking about being in your past relationship, saying like, I felt like I was trying to get shoved into a box and I didn't fit into that box. Mm-hmm. That was like my whole life. So I just like, I'm very attracted to people or interested in people who go their own way, despite maybe what society might think about them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I could
toiling through whatever it is, but remaining true to yourself. And then
yes. And I could tell, I'm like, okay, she's like going her own way. And I want to know about what's going on and like, how'd she get to where she's going? And we got a little bit of background on that. So you sort of fell into streaming. It sounds like the reason you've grown so quickly is you have a good social network of other streamers. But what I've been trying to get to the last 30 minutes is, I think the angle, your branding is good, right? Like, I land on your Instagram and even though I hadn't seen a stream yet, I'm like, okay. Like, I think I can get an idea of what she's about. Then I read her the bio. It's like, into horror games. Makes perfect sense. So
a little
bit
of a shapeshifter. My eyes change. My teeth don't.
Yeah, you did notice like the contacts change a lot. And then I saw some cosplay stuff. I'm like, that makes sense. Or it was like you went to like a Renaissance fair or something. So I know you did some of that stuff.
Yep. Yep, Brent there as well. Yep. I'm sort of almost got my foot in the door to some D&D campaign, like one shots that might be streamed. So that might be a thing this year. And then cosplays, will be most likely like potential goals or just places I end up, because I guess con presence, convention presence seems to be sort of thematic to what my friends do as well. Yeah. And being present for those tabletop games and being present for role playing games, where you're literally acting. You know, I'm very interested in sort of integrating into spaces that might nurture my potential for voice acting. So
I think you're going about it the right way. You know, when I saw it, I just thought, okay, it's always comes at the end of the day, it always comes down to consistency. Like mm-hmm. whoever's the most consistent generally wins out. I think one of my superpowers is I'm not terribly talented in any way, shape or form, but I'm very consistent. And it's worked out well for me. And I saw your brand and your Twitch, and we chatted a little bit. And I just thought, if she sticks with this, she's going to make it work somehow. It's just a matter of if you stick with it, right? And it seems like it's going well for you already. It seems like you have a good plan. I'm going to go to the cons. I have the networking. You seem very intelligent. Like, you understand what it's going to take to turn this into something. And the most important thing is you're legitimately, genuinely passionate about it. You're not trying to make yourself.
It's not lucrative at all. This is purely for me, really, truly. And like, you know, obviously it benefits all of my audience members, right? Which have been growing very quickly. It was, odd, you know, to be a disembodied voice, to be a personality, with just yourself, just your voice, just the way that you interact with people. You know, I have had sort of a bit of a cradle when it comes to my mutuals. And how much they have promoted me or, you know, let me share that space with them and be, you know, an entity in their streams. Especially if you haven't, touched anything in Baldur's Gate at one game of the year. And Baldur's Gate 3 it's so much fun. And there's like tons of mods that you can add and the customizations and the themes. It's so repeat playable that like people have been going crazy for it. So I haven't actually even been able to finish my own game, just trying to balance my own stream and all the games that I've been playing on my own stream, and then also being able to guest. But yes. Most of the time, it's almost like the interactions with the chat create votes, like voting systems, to be able to manipulate whether or not we restart the game or not based on themes. So then you start at the beginning of the game with like new styles of the characters and creating almost like your own storytelling, through the characters that you're making. So it's almost like a joke. But very, very, very fun. But I did fast track. It's strange to me. My view count is larger than my audience.
That's a very good sign.
So that's something. And then also, usually there's a requirement to be able to earn affiliate. I think you have to stream a minimum of 7 times, just in general, just overall 7 times. There's a certain, hour requirement. And then there's also like a 3 times in a month or something like that. But what had happened was I had only gotten to 4 streams and they already made me affiliate before my goals were completed, and nobody ever explained to me why that happened.
Don't worry about it. Just keep going.
But I'm just going to keep going because I enjoy the space and I enjoy the people who have curiosity. They perpetuate curiosity and they do ask me questions and they want to form discussions and they want to have a Discord space where they can go and contemplate those things that they've never thought of before. And I have been told my streams are almost like a form of free college.
I was just going to ask, have you ever had your IQ tested?
Very, very long time ago. I think it was like 140.
I was going to say, I would say you're 130 plus.
Something like that. It's your passion, right? I always say I'm an INTJ if you've ever taken the Myers-Briggs personality test.
I'm the one.
INTJT. I'm the
architect. I'm an INTP, I think.
Okay, I can't remember.
I remember reading it and being like, yeah, I mean, I know people talk shit on Myers-Briggs. It is apparently like 2 ladies that had no back. I mean, I've heard people criticize that. But when I think I'm an INTP for sure.
See, even if it's criticized, you know, some people took the time to be able to actually differentiate different types and if people identify.
I don't know if it's legit, but I remember reading the INTP and I'm like, oh, maybe there are other people out there kind of like me because this seems pretty spot on.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I don't take a ton of stock into it. I just think, I do think it's interesting. I think people get a good sense of what you're about. I want to explore sort of the games that got you here. And one of my favorite things to do, and was one of the things I asked you when you were born, is try to guess what your first console is, which isn't terribly hard if I know the year you were born. But the hardest part about this is whether you had a handheld first or a console. And you did drop some hints. You said I had basically every console, and then you switched to PC. Statistically, you would probably... God damn. It's... You're like right in the middle where if your family was like late to getting stuff, because the Super Nintendo came out in 91, but a lot of people were not, your family would have to be like an early adopter for you to have a Super Nintendo in 92. How old were you when you had your first memory of a game? Don't tell me, just like how, your very first memory of seeing anything video game related, a console.
Oh my God. Well, I'm going to have to give you this hint because my father was a electric engineer.
And it was this, it was either, is it Genesis or the Super Nintendo? I'm going to go Super Nintendo because it sold more.
We did have one. However, my first console was an NES.
That's, I knew it.
And I did have the first Game Boy.
Okay. So what did you, what did you have first, the play first, the Game Boy or the NES?
The NES.
Oh, what do you remember playing?
Duck Hunt.
Duck Hunt.
The Mario games, or at least, I think at least two Mario games were on the NES. And then Castlevania, Metroid, and Kirby. And I was obsessed with, Castlevania.
So you were into the gothic shit straight from the jump.
Right from the womb, probably. My dad was into sci-fi of all kinds, and I've always had the mantra that science fiction has always been a subgenre of horror.
My dad's a big sci-fi head too and got me into it. So yeah, I have
parallels. And then my mother was like a true crime and horror movie buff. So she, like, they just two peas in a pod. I never had any censorship in terms of what I was allowed to be entertained by. In terms of spookiness, I want to say. So yeah, I never really had those limitations of anything really truly scaring me. But yeah, Castlevania was a big one. And then for handhelds, the entire Zelda franchise. I think more Castlevania. Fire Emblem and Golden Sun. I remember Golden Sun very vividly. And obviously I played, my roster is so long. I was concerned. I was like, I don't know if I can actually go over because of how early my start was. And to be, you know, I was fairly isolated and I was bullied a lot. And so obviously that kind of escapism from a very early age is like, I started out weird, so weird.
I find it awesome that you gravitated to Castlevania right from the jump. I think that's badass.
Yeah.
You are the first person, I think, in like whatever 60, 70 episodes to bring up Golden Sun, especially for your age range and how old you were. Mm-hmm. That's quite surprising. That's a lot of reading. I'm obviously you're really smart. I'm assuming you smart from the jump as well.
I blame video games for being smart.
You know what? I think so. Like, I don't,
instead of all those trivial matters and liking boys and having problems and hating your friends, it was more like, well, if people hate me already, like, I'm just going to solve all these really big life issues and all this strategic. You know, I played Final Fantasy Tactics, I think, too.
Well, that's my favorite Final Fantasy. We could do a whole episode on that.
Oh, shit.
I mean, they explore religion and the afterlife and government, and it I love the theme.
You know, yeah, big concepts, not trivial matters, like things that matter, things that were big, things that
but
you have to contemplate.
Tactics, you know, and again, I'll be honest, like I've interviewed a lot of people, talked to a lot of gamers. Most of them are male, not as many females on the actual podcast, but on like the Discord communities, I've talked to a lot. And you are definitely the first female I've talked to that is a tactics fan. And I think for your age, back to what you're saying, I give credit to video games for helping me develop my intellect, because you have to, one, read a lot if you're into RPGs. That's a lot of reading. If you think about putting the, you know, a whole script for a game like Final Fantasy Tactics, I don't know how many pages it would be, but it would be a lot. And then on top of that, you're figuring out game systems and how to exploit them, and it's problem solving, and every game has a slightly different system and a slightly different problem to solve and rules to learn, and then like, how do I break these rules, how do I exploit these rules, how do I get as powerful as I can. The games teach you, they teach you to be rewarding for being thorough, like I'm gonna go explore everything and use
I was a total completionist, and I was like, well, even 12 years old, I'm like, no, it has to be everything, I have to do every side quest, you have to make sure you get all of it. Yeah. And then if you don't, you have to play it again. So that once you're at 89% and you finish the game, you have to go back and get 100.
Yep. And I think, I mean, it could maybe potentially lead to a little bit of OCD. But I think overall,
relax a little bit after.
Yeah.
I actually just went on a little tangent the last stream that I had. And I was like, you know what? I don't really think that rank seems to matter much if you're not directly involved in like a very, very high competing royale of sorts in some game that has a ranking system set in place, because I was a console gamer my whole life, and that I'm level two on Steam right now. Like, there's no evidence to how many games I've truly played, how many franchises I've completed, how many like eclectic games I've tried to get my hands on, like, just, you know.
Yep.
And then the hiatus I had to take too. There's a lot of recent games I haven't played, but man, I don't even know how to cover how many I played, especially with the beginnings.
I like that you brought up Golden Sun. I played one of the predecessors to Golden Sun. It's called Beyond the Beyond. It's Team Camelot. It's one of the worst JRPGs ever made, but I like it because it was my first JRPG that I had on my own. Was it at a friend's house? I don't know if you had the same experience, but growing up, there was always like the friend that had the console you didn't have, or the friends whose dad was a computer engineer and had like PCs. You would try to get, you know, I had a Nintendo's first thing I remember, which is interesting. I was born 7 years before you. I did have a Nintendo, and then we had a Genesis that I saved up for. I didn't get a Super Nintendo until I was like an adult.
My great uncle had an Atari, and I played
2600
Sonic on something. But potentially, he was a second cousin that I called Uncle Tim, but he collected retro games before they were retro. And I mean, like he knew that they were going to have equity. It was kind of, or like he put so much stock into it that I'm sure it was some kind of model. But I didn't really visit him much. I just know that there were a lot of intellectual gentlemen in my bloodline that tended to gravitate towards gaming systems, regardless if they seemed childish.
I know you said you gravitated to Castlevania right from the jump and you were obsessed.
Oh, yeah.
Was there a game? Was it right then you knew you were a gamer? Or was there a game later where you really that really got you and you started thinking like, yeah, I'm a gamer?
It was probably the Zelda franchise and the Final Fantasy franchise after that. So it was like Castlevania was big. Technically, I mean, I loved Castlevania and I loved vampires. I knew about vampires since a very, very young age. I also loved Metroid, and the weight of how much I loved Metroid, because the sci-fi influences of watching Star Trek and watching Star Wars and watching Dune, especially, truly.
We're the same person.
Why are we the same person? I found you. It's a mirror. We're looking in a black mirror right now.
Dude, I remember. Now, I'll be honest. I only read Dune, the first and second book, and I really only got obsessed with the first book. But I probably read that book, I don't know, many, many times. I got obsessed with it. When I saw the trailer for Dune Part 2, like a week ago, I teared up.
I did cry. I did cry. I was also very, very happy to know that Florence Pugh got added to that roster. Oh my gosh, she's such a good actress. She's from Midsommar. She's the princess. I think she got added like last minute, and I don't know what my feelings are for Zendaya, but I did like the cast that they used. And oh my God, Rebecca Ferguson.
I wasn't super stoked on Timothy when they cast him, but after the part one, I'm like, I'm cool with it. He's fine.
A terrible, terrible, terrible turn of events when it comes to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, though.
The Wonka movie?
The Wonka movie. I didn't even see it. I was like, nope.
So I went to go see it with my kids thinking it was going to be dog shit. And I'm not going to say it was great, but
was it kind of like the Alice movie?
It's a kid movie.
Kind of like, oh, it's cute. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a cute little kid movie. So what I love about kids movies, which is why I think Pixar has done so well in general.
Oh, Pixar is huge.
Do you ever watch the show Bluey? I probably don't because you don't have kids.
I've heard of it. I've heard of it 100 times.
Actually, I shouldn't assume you don't have kids. I just assumed you didn't have kids.
I don't have children.
Okay. But Bluey does this thing where like, you look at it like, oh, it's just a little kid show. But then you end up watching it and you realize the writing has layers and there's stuff in there for adults.
Mm-hmm. Wonka
is not as good as I think some of the best. Pixar does this really, really well on some movies. But Wonka has
a... Toy Story?
Yes. Toy Story, I think, is probably the best franchise by them. Mm-hmm. But Wonka has a few layers and threads and character arcs, mm-hmm. where... You know, my kids were oblivious to the nuance, but it kept me entertained and it made me think about my own life. And it got me to think a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I don't want to spoil it for anyone listening. There's a few pivotal moments where Wonka reconciles the death of his mother. And that's his motivation for the whole movie. Mm-hmm. And like kind of the theme and the moral of the story I thought was really, really touching and it paid off. Mm-hmm. It made up for the fact that 90% of the movie, first off, it's a musical and I'm like hit or miss on musicals.
Right.
And, it's for kids and it's just like, like very similar to Alice in Wonderland. And it was okay where I'm like, I can sit through it. My kids are enjoying it, but then it paid off enough in the end where I'm like, I'll give it a little respect. I went into it thinking like, this is going to be like the worst 2 hours of my life. I'm just going to gut through it for the kids. Mm-hmm. I was pleasantly surprised. So I don't want to overhype it because I went in with very low expectations. It's not a good movie, but it's also not a complete waste of time. Anyway, long story short, I think that's a neutral for me with Timothy. Like I don't give it plus or minus for his career. And I was definitely not into his casting on Dune Part 1. Maybe he'll win me over more in Part 2. I think he's good in Part 1. There's other people I would have rather had than him. Anyway, I can't get distracted with Dune.
No, you're good. I remember your question. I retained your question, too. So in terms of development as a gamer, right? Early age, I had gone to almost every family event with, you know, first I had the original Game Boy, then I had a Color, then I had a, what is it, SG? I typically didn't really socialize with my family. You know, I had a book or, it's funny that I wasn't diagnosed. I've been considered normal this whole time. I would pretty much go to every family event with a handheld pretty much glued to my face. I played everything from all the Pokemons to all the Zeldas, you know, to Seasons and Ages and, probably even Spirit Tracks, honestly. And
what's the best handheld Zelda in your opinion?
Oh, man, like I played Seasons so many times because I was frustrated with it. I can't say that it was like my favorite though. And honestly, well, in terms of handhelds, right? I think eventually I got a hold of a PSP to play Crisis Core. So probably Crisis Core. I played Kingdom Hearts also. And then there's Castlevania games too. Shoot. I would get lost in like trying to assert like one. I'm trying to like think of the games that really stuck out in terms of Nintendo. I played all the Star Wars. I played all the Mario. I played all like Soul Calibur. I played Super Metroid, Metroid Prime. I played the Pokemon games. I played Mortal Kombat, Star Fox. But one that stood out for Nintendo specific. I did end up getting Resident Evil 4 on the GameCube. Yep. And I did get Folklore as well, which is a lot of people don't know a lot about.
I can't believe you brought that game up. So
I have it. It's actually sitting upstairs. And I was like, maybe I should try to play this again.
That is a PS3. For those who don't know, it's a PS3, I guess, like kind of JRPG, action RPG. It borrows a lot from like Celtic fairy tales. It's kind of become a cult classic, and it's an RPG that I missed, and I'm launching a new RPG podcast with somebody else, long story short, and we were discussing what the second game we want to play for this series is.
Oh, shoot.
And I brought up Folklore, and
such a good one.
He had heard mixed things about it. I've always been interested in it, so give me your thoughts on it.
Okay, so in terms of Nintendo, right, Nintendo was like youth. I got my PS2, and I did Final Fantasy, I did Resident Evil, I did Silent Hill. I binged a bunch of super gothic, super scary. It was almost like when PlayStation let out the PlayStation 2, it was like all of these meticulously gritty games, and either they were like sci-fi or they were horror, or there was like lots of ghosts, or like, you know, in terms of dungeon crawlers, right, stuff like that. But I kept encountering more, like, I guess they would call it cult classics, or things that weren't expected. So I got Haunting Ground and I got Rule of Rose, and those are two that basically, it involves a female protagonist and they have a dog, either Brown, I think, was the golden retriever in Rule of Rose. And then in Haunting Ground, you have Huey, which is a white German shepherd. And you have to sort of use your wit and really base all of your decision making off of your observation skills and the storyline, as opposed to shoot him up,
biting,
slice him up, you know, explode everything. So with that, when I got my PS3, getting Folklore was like, it was story specific. It was very story heavy. It was almost like Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles in a way, where it was more slow paced. There are two different perspectives. So there's the detective, and then there's like the girl. And so you can play them separately. And some Japanese games had done that in the past, regardless if they were appreciated for it or not. A lot of spooky games did that, or even, there's a game that I didn't play that sort of did that. Fatal Frame.
I'm surprised you haven't played Fatal Frame. That's
I know. I'm surprised I haven't played Fatal Frame, honestly. I truly am. Where basically your protagonist is somebody who's subjected to a fighting style of only using a
camera. Yeah.
Which is terrifying. And so like the suspense and the stress of feeling like you're gonna, that you're vulnerable, that vulnerability,
that's a good
and that
point.
Storytelling is a theme that's hard to find in a lot of video games. And I was looking for that by the time I got to Folklore.
And that's a good point you brought up, because I had never thought about this, right? In my mind, when you think of horror games, there's like horror games where your character is capable and there's some sort of like fighting, shooting, whatever. And there's like a subgenre of horror games. Again, we talked about genres and labels. In my mind, I would label it as like where your character is not capable of like fighting.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to say competent, because they are competent in a lot of these games. And I didn't realize that I can't. It seems like that started with the PS2, because you brought up Haunting Ground and Rule of Rose, which are both considered cult classics in the survival horror genre. Mm-hmm. And I'm racking my brain as you're talking and to think of, besides Fatal Frame, Rule of Rose, and Haunting Ground, on PS1, I can't think of a survival horror game where your character did not have any fighting. Like even Silent Hill 1, you had a gun and you had like a wooden stick. You weren't like a special ops Navy SEAL or anything, but you did have the ability to fight enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Silent Hill 3, you could. I think you're right. Like I mean, I'm not a gaming historian.
I know.
But those are some of the earliest examples of a survival horror where your character is unable to fight. You have to use your wits. Mm-hmm. You have to hide. You have to use the environment. You have to use deductive reasoning. Outlast is like a more common or a more newer iteration of that? I don't know if you played Outlast, but the same thing, all you have
to do. I was just playing Outlast Trials yesterday. Yesterday we were playing Outlast Trials, which is like, there's Outlast, and then Outlast Trials is the Steam version where you can communally play with a member of four members to your party. And it is gruesome. It's
Outlast is too much.
Gritty. It's gritty and I love it. We had so much fun. It was terrifying. It was so scary. Yeah.
You were more powerful than I played Outlast. Outlast 1 was too good. It was like
too good
because I got probably like 3 or 4 hours into it. And I thought, dude, this is like 95% panic attack. Like it's too much for me.
I love the psychological challenges, right? Like I feel like a lot of games where you feel like you're invincible because you have access to supplies. You have unlimited resources to some degree even, right? You have military background. You have vehicles and weapons and bombs and things that you can protect yourself with, right? Like, you don't have to feel vulnerable. But when some of them, right? American McGee's Alice.
That's true.
Right? I think I was gravitated towards not just video games that had female protagonists, but it just happened to be the case that some of those horror games had the female protagonists available to be that vulnerable state, to, you know, have detection, avoidance, and stealth, and to have moral compasses, and to have limited resources and challenges where you have to conserve ammo. That shit's not just going to be available to you. Your gun's going to be a paperweight. There's going to be variables where you're going to lose all your items. Sometimes games might be considered far too easy now because you have a plethora of all these things that make you feel safe, as opposed to having the games that really get gritty and make you have like decision making involved in everything that you're doing. And there's so much weight in a lot of those Japanese style games, especially from Konami. But Resident Evil did it too. Resident Evil, the whole franchise was inspired by difficult angles, right? When you're being attacked, those impractical controls were used because you're frustrated, but you're also under a form of stress of not having all of your faculties, of being in a situation where maybe a shock factor is imminent, where things make you think, that make you stop, and try to create some form of reality of not just being desensitized to everything in every situation and exploding things out of your way and blowing away all the problems, is that there's so much emotional weight involved and there's so much to contemplate in terms of what the hell is happening to you, that psychological trauma has its own factors, and some modern games really take that away, that because people get inconvenienced by it, I want to say, and I have only come to appreciate it ever the more stronger to find video games that do that. And I feel like Folklore did have that kind of weight, and it had weight in both a female protagonist and a male protagonist. And Silent Hill 2 was huge for me because it didn't matter that Sutherland was a guy. Any of the protagonists in Silent Hill specifically, whether it be a female or a male, it was more about the story, about what they were dealing with and what the connections were and who they're trying to figure things out. And the people that they're supposed to know, or the people that they do know, are not actually themselves. It's like they're figments or they're versions of themselves, and they're still trying to figure something out. There's space for rounding characters, where a lot of characters in modern games seem complete already. That the story doesn't necessarily need to be told, or their tragic past is already done, and now that they have persevered through that, they're just a fighting machine, you know, and they're going to take down the enemy. And, you know, it's not always clear cut like that. I feel like a lot of Japanese modeled games have a weight that certain American games are missing. And that might be controversial, but there's so much room for emotion.
I have a question about your interpretation of Silent Hill 2, because I got into a good spirited debate about this game on another podcast semi-recently. And did you interpret Silent Hill as James?
Sunderland?
Yes, James.
Mm-hmm. James.
Yeah.
And Mary. And Maria.
So, spoiler alert for those who haven't played it, the remake's coming. James goes to Silent Hill because his dead wife writes him a letter. She's supposed to be dead. She says, come to my special place where we went to, I think on our honeymoon or something. It was at the lake house at Silent Hill. He goes there. He meets a bunch of other people. The twist is you find out that he actually killed his wife, and he's dealing with, like, coming to terms with what he did. And Silent Hill is like a city that is like, well, you were talking about a black mirror. It reflects your own psyche back at you and, like, twists it. And that's, like, pretty common knowledge about Silent Hill, I think, in extended lore, too. But the debate we got into was, are all the other people real? And that they're also attracted to Silent Hill and going through their own version of Silent Hill, and it's testing their consciousness. And Silent Hill attracts people who are tortured or struggling. Or the other interpretation is that Silent Hill in this form, James is already dead and he's in purgatory. Mm-hmm. And all those other people are just part of his own subconscious. And that he's not actually physically... Silent Hill 1 and 3, it's explicitly stated, like, you are in the town of Silent Hill. Mm-hmm. There's a cult, like, it's in the real world, where some people interpret Silent Hill 2 is he was just in purgatory and it took shape of the town Silent Hill because he had been there. What are your thoughts on that?
In terms of open interpretation, I probably would side with the latter, in terms of the manifestation and that Black Mirror becoming Silent Hill. Silent Hill must be a place or an anchor, right? Something that had been opened. And in terms of, like, maybe souls getting caught there, right, that kind of makes sense to some people. But it does genuinely feel like, and especially with the theme going on between not just 2, but also 3, but also Homecoming and Downpour, that Silent Hill seems like an anchor point. It is a place. It does a thing. But the way that people end up there, that Black Mirror seems to be the second part of what you had said, where those people are irrelevant. Those, the versions of themselves and then the souls that are lost there present themselves in a way that would only be relevant to the protagonist. Mm-hmm. And they don't always seem to make sense, because it almost feels like there is an ambiance or an entity or an anthropomorphic state of this place that is integrating itself in, manifesting itself in forms of grief, the stages of grief, it almost feels like. If you think of the stages of grief, it begins with shock, and then there's denial, and then there's anger and bargaining and depression, acceptance and hope, and then processing grief. And depending on how closely you try to snipe the games in their entirety, of each of the scenes progressing one after the other, the things that they have to do, or the things, no matter how simple, because sometimes the dialogue is to die for in terms of how simplistic it was in nature. It was more about the ambiance of everything.
Yeah.
And a lot less about the fact that they weren't really getting what was happening to them, right? Some of those, like, dumb lines and some of those questions that were being asked of being like, well, who are you? Or like, no, right? You get to a point in each one of those games where those symbols of, like, the people that they knew, they don't necessarily really fit. It's like they weren't supposed to be. They're like, why are you here? Or, like, you know, why is it your name this? Or why do you look just like the person that I know, but you're not them? You know, so it doesn't really seem like these people have agency, but they exist as symbols. They exist as figments. They exist as symbols for something that the protagonist is supposed to be going through and processing through grief, especially with a lot of the graphic stuff that happens. I was just thinking, Downpour got a lot of grief. Downpour got a lot of shit, but it was very artistic. And it was, they were brand new developers, I want to say. They were both Homecoming and Downpour. There were new developers that were taking on the magnificent task of trying to make a really, really good game, and potentially, like, under a lot of pressure, not necessarily performing as well as they could have in terms a lot of disappointment that came from those games. But I loved Downpour.
I have not played Downpour.
Because a lot of people hated it. They're like, it's the worst Silent Hill game in the history of Silent Hill games. And probably the worst and most annoying part of the whole thing is the frustration with the enemies, the fighting systems, and the fact that you don't get a lot of shock because they're all kind of humanoid. But the storyline and the things that you encounter and the choices that you can make to change the ending, that was sort of a new thing, too. That there's like five different endings, I think, in Homecoming. I think genuinely, based on all of them, even the playable teaser, right? It's like some things you know about what the protagonist did, and most of the protagonists are not necessarily good people, you know, and either they had a tragedy happen or they were the cause of that tragedy. And that's usually like that's a known trope. That's not even a spoiler. You know that going into the game, but experiencing and going through the majority of all of those storylines, there's themes that recur. There's anchor points. There's personality traits. And there's always like things that are missing. But the things that are normally consistent is that both the enemies have ambiguity and whoever the protagonist interacts with has just the same amount, if not more, ambiguity.
Yeah.
That's like that uncanny valley of I know you, but I don't know you, and I never know you because you're not them, but you are them. And I need to live with this paradox while I'm moving through something that is so horrifying. I don't think I can do it.
Yeah.
And you have to anyway.
I definitely think that I think you can pin down that the enemies are a reflection of the protagonist's psyche. And it's
definitely Pyramid Head.
Yeah. Absolutely. Pyramid Head. I think the fact that all the nurses are sexy in Silent Hill 2, back when he would visit her. And it's just, I don't want to give too much away because the remake is coming out. I mean, I did give away the big spoiler, but they could change stuff. They might be able to change some details. I guess the question is are the other people physically there and also drawn to Silent Hill, or the other people, like the enemies, only a reflection of the protagonist's consciousness?
Yeah, and I think the latter.
Yeah, I was actually arguing for the former on this podcast. Oh. But Chris, my buddy, a really good friend, Retro Hangover podcast, Christian Shane, if you listen to this, it sounds like she sides with you, Chris. I can see the argument for that. And Chris made some, we were talking about Silent Hill 2 specifically.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you've played some of the games I haven't played, like I have not played Shattered Memories or Downpour or... Mm-hmm. Homecoming. And so you are pulling from more lore. You have more data than I do. So I might have to defer on you on that one. I could see both. I thought because of 1 and 3, I'm pretty familiar with the lore of 1 and 3, 1 being the one I played the most. Silent Hill is definitely in those games a physical place.
Oh, yeah.
And they are there.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you're arguing for a third option, which is not that James is in purgatory, that he is physically in Silent Hill, but the other people are like the enemies. They are a reflection of him, not actually there.
Well, I would say it is a form of purgatory, because I did mention, so I am supporting that. See, I'm sort of a weird, I feel like I might be in between the two of you too, because it is a place. And unfortunately, with like all the expansive knowledge I know, right, there has been an evolution over the course of a lot of years, decades, right, of the developing lore and the continuous lore and each game building on top of itself, a different scenario, but almost the same tropes, that Silent Hill is a place that could be considered ambiguously enough to be a purgatory of sorts, that it is removed from general reality.
Like you couldn't just drive
most
there.
Likely deceased. Yeah, yeah, no. And it is a point of no return by definition by now, that the Silent Hill is not something you can return from.
Okay. So it might exist physically, but it only allows people who
it's a portal
to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that portal is basically probably the best analogy for death and processing.
I think Shane was arguing on, and then I could, sorry, correct me if I'm wrong. Shane was saying that, like, if you went to Silent Hill and you had no, like, serious issues or trauma, you wouldn't know that it's this kind of a cursed place. You would just think like, oh, it's a regular town. But if you go there and you have demons, it will reflect those demons back at you. But you're saying it is a form of purgatory. Maybe it does exist physically. I do agree with you. It is a point. I can't think of a single person who really, well, doesn't the protagonist of Silent Hill 3 return from Silent Hill?
So Heather. Cheryl, Heather does, but I feel like her lore, it's unique to the fact that her storyline wasn't based in death. Is like more like family, like bloodline, if I can remember it right. And so hers is a little bit more messed up. And the thing is that Homecoming was also based on sort of like bloodline as well, but the circumstances were different. So spoiler for Homecoming. So basically the style of Homecoming was the protagonist was in search of his brother. And by the time he had found his brother in Silent Hill, the way that he had experienced it, right? He realized that he was responsible for the sacrificial death of his younger brother through bloodline, which it should have been him, but it wasn't him. But he accessed Silent Hill because he basically was in a coma that he didn't wake up from.
So that
was this portal, right? Like it kind of like
Silent
this
Hill doesn't. Or it could exist physically, but it also exists in the other realm, whatever.
It's another realm. Yeah. It's a separate dimension. It's a place where people go to process grief. And sometimes it seems to be a physical place. It was inspired by a physical place, like a mining town in Pennsylvania. Being in the physical, and being in this specific realm, and having something terrible happen to you, most of the time Silent Hill seems to be the manifest of reliving nightmares, reliving traumas, and regrets and situations that haven't been processed yet. And so through those stages of grief, right, it seems to me that it has a way of being ambiguous on purpose to the fact that it is a purgatory. It is a real place and it is a mental space. It can't necessarily be defined to a point of complete understanding because then otherwise it would lose its luster in terms of what its purpose is. And what its purpose is to draw you away from reality in order to process grief.
I like that you brought up that it can't be fully defined or explained because that kind of ruins the point. Also, enjoying it as a fan, like there always has to be this balance of mystery, but also it needs to make some internal logical sense, not to be contradictory at every turn and break on its own logic. And I think I've been wanting to ask you about this game because it's my personal favorite world and lore building and has similar themes. Did you ever play Control?
I'm actually playing it right now for stream. I started it on Tuesday last
How
week.
Far are you?
I am not very far. I have met with Emily Pope, but I love it.
You and I so need to do another Control specific podcast when you are done.
My full review.
Because that is the only game. I mean, I've gotten into the lore and world building of mini games, but as far as a game that I read every single piece of paper, every single note, I watched every single little
I've been reading it for stream. I have been reading it for stream. And
it connects to Alan Wake and the Sam Lake universe. And yeah, I don't want to, I can't talk about it because you're playing it, but I would say like, don't sleep on the world and the lore building on that game. You can miss a lot. Like a lot of it's stuff you could just pass and not read. You can read items. You can read, there's like little audio clips. There's this whole side series of these like of a children's TV show that the Federal Bureau of Control made as a part of like predictive programming for society.
I've seen Dr. Darling.
And they're super creepy. Just don't sleep on the world and the lore building. A lot of it is optional and you can miss a lot of it. I would love to talk about that after you're done because that
Absolutely.
is I just got a new video card specifically to play Alan Wake 2. I'm not playing this game unless I can play it in its full glory because the universe is too good.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll be playing Alan Wake 2, which in the DLC of Control, this is not a spoiler. It was part of this.
I got the Ultimate Edition, so I should have the DLCs complete.
The DLC has Alan Wake directly in it, and it shows you how the two games connect narratively.
Oh, fascinating.
That's all I'll say. So are you familiar with Alan Wake? I'm assuming you've probably played
it. I am. Unfortunately, that one I didn't play myself. I watched someone play it vicariously.
So good enough.
Enough.
I played it actually after Control because I loved Control so much. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, this is connected, and so now I got to go play Alan Wake, and I loved it.
I feel like that would be appropriate. I probably should do the same.
Based on your taste, I think you'd like Alan Wake. It's older. It's got some archaic controls, but they also have a remastered version on Steam and I think Games Pass. And
how many people have already talked about Silent Hill and Resident Evil?
Silent Hill 2 comes up. I mean, I bring it up a lot because it's one of my favorites.
It's huge. It's huge.
Those are bigger ones, but you
especially
are definitely
musically.
You are definitely the first person to bring up Haunting Ground, Rule of Rose, 100%. That's a random game that I only played because I saw a YouTube video where someone made a texture pack for it and I thought the graphics looked cool. So I downloaded the texture pack. I went through the emulation process, figured out my settings, and then started playing it and was like, this is actually pretty cool. I'm going to keep playing it. And ended up really liking that. It's a very slow paced. It's a very different game.
It's moody. Yeah. I would like to say it's moody. I look for moody games.
And so you first want to bring again, it's Golden. You brought up Golden Sun. We could go off tangents on RPGs forever because that's like my bread and butter. But what I do want to ask you is narrative wise, and I want to be very specific about this, which game has elicited the biggest emotional response out of you?
I would say I have played Resident Evil 8 The Village 5 times. I don't necessarily know if it, you know, everybody makes fun of it for being like the perfect goth package, right? It's goth fantasy. You get the factory, you get the castle and the vampire, you get like the murky mire, and you get the dollhouse, right? With the dollhouse is almost like PT. It's got the children and the hallways and the labyrinth, and the fact that Ethan Winters puts up with so much crap and he takes so much abuse. And he seems like an unusual hero of being like, he doesn't really have much to say, but he is the world's best father. I've gone through that game so many times. And I want to say and that's recent. You know, there were some more like emotional responsive ones. Fallout 4, but that's not necessarily story. That was like just in terms of immersibility, just being able to like let go and kind of do that open world. I don't care, the world is over, let it burn kind of emotions. And then like Borderlands 2, those really resonated with me.
Borderlands 2 has probably made me laugh the most consistently.
Positive. I remember a game called Remember Me.
The French studio that did the sci-fi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved their soundtrack. I loved that you could make your own combos.
Yes.
You made your own fucking combos in the game and it could be different every time. But yeah, I would say I did lose my father in 2018. It was a very tragic thing for me and parts of me, I'm still not over it. Just the way that it happened, but I must have gotten some sort of solace with Ethan as a character that would like never give up on his daughter kind of vibe. And even though that seems a little bit cliche, it was just something that I kept gravitating back to and still being able to fucking shoot him up, but all of them are like werewolves, like in tropes, vampires, right? Robots, like animatronics, right? Everything that a goth girl needs to be happy in one game.
It's interesting that it was like a connection to like a a relative or, you know, a bloodline, I guess your dad, was the backbone of why, potentially why that game was so resonating for you. For me, it's the other way around. The Last of Us 2, particularly the Anna. Have you played that game?
I love The Last of Us. Okay. I have such a long list. It's hard.
It's
like, man, it's
we
so
can have, we can have you on again. We can talk. It's not a big deal.
We talk about something else. Last of Us was so good with the story. They weren't even related, but they kind of ended up sort of having to be that like found family for each other.
Yeah, because Ellie and Joel's relationship is a father-daughter relationship, even though they're not technically father-daughter. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is a huge spoiler. If you haven't played Last of Us 2, go play it, turn it off. But at the end, when Ellie gets in a position to take revenge on Abby for killing Joel.
Oh, yeah. I actually have that on TikTok.
Yeah. It's, I'll probably get emotional talking about it. But so I have two little girls.
Oh.
And what was so genius about that game, which will lead into my next question, which is I want you to start thinking about, is what is your favorite character development arc? Specifically, which character do you think? And what I loved about this game is we had like a double whammy. One, we love Joel and we love Ellie. The game comes out, Joel gets killed. We hate Abby, right? Fuck this girl. Oh, yeah. She killed, and Ellie's our girl. But then they start making you play as Abby. And I knew right from the jump, I'm like, these motherfuckers are going to make me fall in love with Abby and try to show me why she did what she did. And I'm like, there's no way. I hate her for life. But over the course of the game, you see Abby trying to redeem herself. She feels bad about killing Joel. The people with her feel bad about it. She's trying to come to grips with that. She's coming out of the darkness that she lost herself to revenge. She got the revenge. It didn't bring her peace. And now she's coming to grips with that. Ellie becomes obsessed with revenge. And over the course of the game, goes into darker and darker places. She starts killing people more indiscriminately. And by the end of the game, she finally gets to Abby and she's going to give in and she's going to lose herself to what I would say the darkness. And she has a flashback of Joel laying where he, right as he was dying, because she was hiding, watching him get killed. And he doesn't say anything. She just sees his face and she realizes like he would want her to rise above. He wouldn't want her to descend into the darkness. He knows that Joel lived kind of a bad life. We learn about that in the first game. It didn't bring him peace. And part of the reason he did what he did with killing the Fireflies is he was trying to make up for losing his daughter. And he had a complicated relationship. And Ellie just realizes like she doesn't honor Joel, her dad, or Suedo dad, by killing Abby. She actually honors him by forgiving her and letting go. And she lets Abby go. It's the only game that I was like legitimately crying. And then, you know, sometimes other games have done this. Movies will do this. Certain music will do this. But then for like weeks after I beat that game, I was just like in a different headspace. I couldn't stop thinking about it. But what I thought was interesting, if I didn't have kids and if I wasn't thinking about like what legacy I'm going to leave behind my kids and if I'm a good dad and all that stuff, I don't know if that scene would have hit me as hard. And I haven't, my dad is pretty old and I probably am going to lose him pretty soon, but I bet if I had lost my dad, Resident Evil 8 might have hit me the same way, right? And it's interesting how that's what I find interesting. It's like everyone resonates for different things based on their life experience. And a lot of people hated Last of Us 2, didn't resonate with it at all. And they thought it was
A lot of people hated that. I was disappointed to hear that it had such a bad review. It's just like, There was a couple, I think a couple audios I got off of some of my TikToks that I did like two acting reels from that game. And there were people who actually commented and they were like, that game would have been better if it was never made. And I was like, ouch.
I mean,
man. I mean, I get it. Like if it's too emotional for you or if you think this is just like an angsty teen that's got a little bit too much firepower. Like, oh, okay. But you're not really paying attention. You ever play Between Two Souls?
Beyond Two Souls?
Or Beyond Two Souls. That's what it was.
Yes.
I watched that one too. That was
Dude, I'm crazy. Glad you brought that up because, man. Yeah, yeah. So I played through that whole game on PS3 when it came out. I love Quantic Dream games. I love that they're kind of like they're doing their own thing, right? It's like a movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't know, I guess, how to address it because Ellie's, or the actress is now a he, but she was a she at the time of the game. Anyway, so that actor, actress, Ellen, or Elliot Page. Ellen Page at the time of the game, Elliot Page now, she plays a character where her brother, well, she has like a soul, like a ghost that follows her around.
Right. Yeah.
For those who haven't played. Yeah. And then she kind of discovers the mystery of why she has this soul attached to her, who that soul is. And then at the very end of the game, you get to make a choice. And all I'll say is, yes, I have played that game. And that moment of making a choice, I sat there, I think for like 30 minutes. Like, I don't know what to do. Cause part of me wants to go join on the other side, go to the other side. Part of me wants to stay back.
And you can't save scum.
Yes.
Choose one to make the weight of the journey finalized.
I love that game. I'm glad I usually don't bring it up. I forgot about it. That one really.
Measles, yeah.
I loved the section when you go to like the Indian reservation. It's like three quarters of the way through the game and you spend some time. I have this fascination with like skinwalkers and cause, like from you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I like the fact that you call them skinwalkers. Not everybody does.
Yeah, I'm from Utah, so it's very
perfect. Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, strangely enough, the ex Mormon that I know is also from Utah.
Well, I mean, most Mormons come from Utah, so.
Well, perfect. Well, that makes sense now.
Not surprised. It's like the homeland of Mormons. There's when I grew up in Utah, the city I lived in was like 95% Mormon. I didn't know anyone who wasn't Mormon.
My, wow.
Until I was like 20. So I grew up.
Didn't really have a choice in the matter.
No choice. No. Yeah. But I think, Skinwalker lore is like a big part of Utah culture. And so that I've had some like, unexplainable experiences out in the Utah wilderness. And I always ask my guests, I'm obsessed with this kind of stuff. Have you had any experiences that like you can't make sense of? Seeing things, lights in the sky,
oh, man,
apparitions?
Let me tell you. I'm a vampire. What does that say? No, I would like to say that I have a very in-depth background of a lot of happenstances to the point where my capstone in phenomenology, so existentialism, right? What it is to exist and to be a being in the world and to experience things as such in perceptions. I've been close enough to death where those experiences have stuck with me and they changed me permanently. And in terms of being that close to death, I think that it, I don't know if it changes you physiologically, right? But, to grow up, I grew up, on a bluff. My dad built his own house. He engineered his own house, and complete with a boiler building, a wood stove, centralized heating system, to like a three-story split-level house in the middle of a forest. And I would like to say that I have experienced a lot of things and that go bump in the night that make it so that I analyze horror on a daily basis because of it, maybe to process it and maybe also to make sense of it and to accept it for what it is and to understand that, humans don't always have the capacity of absorbing everything that they see, and understanding it. But I grew up, isolated and playing video games, a big house on the hill, entities and whatnot. But I do have one pretty grave fever dream that I remember as a child before I understood what devils were. That was before my near-death experiences, that I had a knack for running down this really, really long hallway to get to my parents' room. And there were always night lights because I was afraid of the dark. And I would probably say that I'm still never in complete darkness. I had gotten to their room by, hauling all the way down this one tiny, from one little light to the doorknob, right? You feel like you're running all this way, the best that you can muster. And I got to the other side of the door, and I had understood myself to crawl in bed with my parents and to lay down and fall asleep. But to wake up again, to go to the bathroom in the dark, because there wasn't a nightlight in the room on the other side. And so they, the master bedroom had a balcony, you know, out looking out to all these beach house windows, even though it was in the middle of forest land.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, forest land. And so I'm trying to find the light, and I'm just a tiny girl. So I can't, I find the light switch. I barely reach it. And I try to turn it on and off and on and off and on and off. And it's not working. So this is basically probably one of my first sleep paralysis dreams. Because my capstone was also, there's a second capstone that was talking about sleep paralysis. This half bath in the master bedroom. It was a toilet, a sink counter, and a standing shower with a gazebo window. I was too afraid to actually go to the bathroom because I couldn't turn the light on, and it felt like the whole room was warping. The lights didn't seem to make sense. Physics didn't seem to make sense anymore. It felt like there was a concave, convex thing going on in the room. And I could see red and green, but we were in darkness. So the colors didn't make sense. And I had seen a cloven-hoofed, furry, black, 7-foot-tall thing poking its head out from the gazebo door. And all I could see were those red eyes. And I was like, I am probably like before the age of 5, where my parents wouldn't have ever been able to describe what that beast might have been. And it still to this day makes no sense to me that I could have comprehended something like that at such a young age. You know, and there's always the skeptics that say that there's false memories implanted and stuff like that. But it's just, I was so mortified that my parents had woke up with me in the bathroom screaming, unconscious, like both unconscious and screaming. And I have had like childhood friends' moms tell my parents that I would do the same thing where I would be unconscious but screaming, and they would be like, that is so scary.
I think I have unconventional views. So my interpretation of that, and again, I don't know. This is just my interpretation.
Sleep paralysis, right?
Well, I think sleep paralysis is real. I think that just because we have, just because we have a label for it doesn't mean we actually understand what's going on, and that there's nothing. So what happens is someone in academia will say, well, we know what that is. That's sleep paralysis. Okay, sure. Yeah. The whole point, you know, I will say this. I've experimented with astral traveling.
Me too.
I don't know. Like, I can't definitively say, is my consciousness actually going somewhere, or am I just exploring my subconscious? I don't know. But what I do know is you can follow a protocol, and then you can have the experience that sure seems like you're leaving your body and your consciousness is traveling somewhere. I've never like had someone put like a code inside a safe somewhere and then go and travel and try to look
at remote viewing.
You know, I don't know.
Right.
But what I do know is you can follow a protocol and you can have these experiences. What I think is happening is that when your body falls asleep, sleep paralysis, but your brain isn't in a full sleep state, I think you're in this in-between state, and I do think, you know, there are realms of consciousness.
Liminal spaces.
There's a space in between, and I think that place is, quote, real. It's not real the same way this material dimension is real, but it's real in a sense, and that when you are in sleep paralysis, you can observe and interact and see things that you can't see in normal waking state. But it's, I don't think it's just in your head. And people say, well, it's just in your head. You're just dreaming. Like, well, how do you know what's your brain is real? So how do you know what your brain is not making is real? Like, even if it is just, quote, in your head. I personally think there is like a realm. There are more dimensions and realms in existence. And I think as we move forward, we'll discover them and have explanations for them. Yet.
Absolutely. The discussion on metaphysics, metaphysics and phenomenology are adjacent to each other, but they obviously argue different parameters in terms of what constitutes reality and stuff. But I've studied metaphysics too, and you're totally on the right track that I think, we are capable of trying to explain away what is happening. But really, what constitutes reality? Perception. If you're perceiving those things, they constitute reality. That is the thing. That's the recessive statement of being like, if there's an undeniability that this thing was real to someone, and the fact that it happens to so very many of us, the things that we see that we don't talk about, or the things that we see that we talk very avidly about and no one believes us, both of those two things, they still constitute reality. We still know what the Hat Man is. We still know what the Blob is. We still know what the Devil is, right? We still know Nachnitza, the sleep demon, the cat that keeps you from breathing.
Yes. I mean, that's very common to have something on your chest, right? Sleep paralysis. I think that sleep paralysis is real, but I just think being in that state opens you up to perceiving things that you normally can't perceive. And I think those things are, quote, real in some sense. So I think that what you saw probably was like, hey, you kind of slipped into its realm. And it was like, hey, what are you? I haven't seen you before.
Like I tapped into something accidentally in adolescent, in early youth.
I used to have a lot of wild astral-traveling dreams as a kid. And then I lost it.
Like you're flying. Like you don't require your body. No. I did experience those things. I mean, man.
There was a period in my life where almost every night I dreamt I could control my dream, lucid dreaming.
Lucid dreaming.
And I would fly all the time. Then I lost it. And then I became curious about it later in my life because I did have I had an experience I'm still trying to make sense of in high school in the Utah wilderness where, long story short, I saw an orb, like totally awake, sober.
That was the first thing that I saw in childhood. They were
that's what I was going to ask
from
you.
My window.
Orbs are the most common, I think, from listening to hundreds and maybe even thousands of podcasts and being obsessed with the subject. Mm-hmm. I would say orbs are the most common unexplainable sighting that people experience.
The ones that you don't, the experiences where you perceive them without equipment. That's the shit.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that experiencing them with equipment is fraud. It's just that the most striking phenomena of the ones that happen to you where you're like, I can't deny that.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it's happening. And I don't even have time to capture it because I'm wrapping my mind around this right now. Is like that those are very moving moments.
Yeah, I'm 20 years later, I'm still trying to make sense of that experience, which is that one experience is why I'm obsessed with the subject. And it's why I always ask people, because you mentioned something earlier, the things that people don't tell others, that is more often than not. I have found that there are people I know in my life through, like, I do a lot of jiu-jitsu training, MMA training, and someone recently that I've been friends with for years got them to open up, and they told me some wild stories that happened to them personally. And I know this person. They're not lying. They're not crazy. They're not looking for attention. In fact, they're the opposite. They don't tell anyone these things because they're afraid of what people will think about them. But they're real experiences. And I think that I'm glad you brought this up and you're open to say it. I think people should talk about these things more. I have a suspicion that almost every single human being has had one experience that they can't.
It's so human. It's integratively human. Like I am drawn, and I know a lot of people have been drawn to the genre of horror for a reason, right? It's identifiable, and it's sometimes therapeutic for people who have experienced traumas, life traumas, not just things that are practical, not just things that are normative, not things that you can explain to other people, things that are very intimately yours and yours alone, something that you have to process, something that you're not done processing, right? And you don't like to share those things always openly. There's a very big stigma, especially in American culture, to push that very thing completely under the rug where you cannot see it. You don't want to see death. You don't want to see abject. You don't want to see flaws. You don't want to see weakness. You don't want to see vulnerability. And it is so very human to have all of those components in the forefront of your life very intimately, to be able to wear them and to be able to know them and to be able to identify them and to be able to process them. And the best way to process things is to not only share them, but to know that you're not alone.
Yes.
And when it comes to the uncanny valley, when it comes to the paranormal, when it comes to things that you can't explain, the liminal spaces that you end up in, the questionabilities of what humanity has in store for you, and what you are and what your purpose is, right? All of that significantly changes when you encounter really hard truths and horrific events.
Mm.
And you don't necessarily need it. There's no requirement, especially to your audience, right? Like, there's no requirement to have a trauma, to be able to identify with those things, but to know and respect vulnerability being shown. It is a human thing. It is the most human thing. And I think in terms of what my Twitch channel is going to be geared towards, is being able to be vulnerable, is being able to be intimate, is being able to have that transformative genre of being able to conceive of both the monster and the survivor, and not just those tropes, but being able to see trauma and to not shove it away, to be able to talk about it and to process it, you know. And you don't have to process it forcefully. It's just that it is a very human thing, and it shouldn't be hidden away, because all of us are carrying something. And I feel like the horror genre is a perfect, it's a masterful, every single horror game that I have ever played, at least attempts not just for scare factor, but for storyline, right? And it's always a tragic character. It has to do with how to process tragedy. And if we lose that muscle because we're hiding away from it all the time, it's not going to be a very healthy journey.
Yeah. There's also a weird correlation between trauma and unexplainable experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that they definitely seem to be correlated. I didn't have a particularly like acute traumatic childhood. It was more of like a slow burn with some religious stuff, but I actually had quite a good childhood. I only had that one, really, it was a very long, prolonged experience. It was like about a 45-minute experience. Like, it wasn't like a quick thing. Like, I watched this orb put on a show for me and other people, and I did what a lot of people did. I was like, I had no way to make sense of it, so I just like pretended like it didn't happen.
Really?
10 or 15 years. But it was always there. And then I started looking into it. And like you said, talking about it. And when I found some experiencers, I started diving down like the UFO. I thought for sure it had to be a UFO, right? It was some sort of craft with a light attached to it. Cause there was I had no concept of like a ball of energy, an orb or a spirit or something like that. Anyway, then I ended up like finding many people who had similar experiences and started making sense of it. And since then, I've been super curious. Like, anytime I can get someone to feel comfortable, I want to ask them that, because I have been blown away that almost everybody has had at least one or two experiences that they can explain. And they're either actively trying to process or they haven't really thought about it. And then they bring it up and they tell me, and it's so prevalent. People will say, well, you were just on, you know, every time I tell someone the orb story, were you high? No, I wasn't high. And even if I was, it doesn't matter. It still happened. Were you crazy? Or did other people, like, I get the skepticism.
It shouldn't be explained away. It should just be explained.
Well, it might be. Like,
you know?
I would say there are people out there that lie about things to get attention.
Oh, God, yeah. No, a lot of people ruin it.
That's true. But my experience when asking people, most people don't want to tell you because they don't want to be judged. They're actively not lying about it. They don't want to tell you the truth about it because they're scared that telling the truth is going to make you judge them. You're going to think they're a liar. You're going to think they're crazy. So the amount of experiences that people have had and throughout history and in my own little, like, sort of low level, what would you call it? Anecdotal research where I just talk to people and I ask them, I would say 80 to 90% of people have had some sort of experience. And I would say 80 to 90% of those people.
Like a social experiment. Yeah.
Yeah. Like they're not crazy. They're not lying. They had the experiences they said they had. Now, their interpretation of the experience, I may or may not agree with. Like if they come from a really, really like hardcore religious background, maybe they interpret it through that lens.
Right.
And I think like, I don't know if that interpretation is accurate, but I don't know if mine is either. But what I do know is people are having these unexplainable experiences and they're not just crazy and they're not just on drugs. Like there is something else going on here back. And that's why I got interested in astral traveling. It's like something is going on here. Do I know if I'm going into my own subconscious or actually projecting my consciousness out into the quote real world? No, I don't. But I do know you can have the experience. You can follow the protocol and you can have the experience. Just like I know if you eat 5 grams of mushrooms, some shit's going to happen.
Right. Yeah. Like. Yeah. I have had the privilege of being in a number of cons, with my friend Gareth West, who is a hypnotist. So, we've done hypnosis sessions together, and I've done them on stage as well. And it's sort of, a similar state of mind to be able to wield your subconscious in a communion with people.
Mm.
And it's the state of subconscious thought where half of you is conscious and half of you is unconscious, where pre-reflexive motions seem to be what's controlling you at the time. And I guess control is, that's a loaded word for what hypnosis does. But in terms of like astral projection, right, it's the same state of mind, only like most of the time I would only astral project or attempt to do something of the like in the privacy of my home and my sanctuary, right? Somewhere where you feel safe and secure, where you can travel without being disturbed. And so it's the same level of consciousness. It's somewhere in that liminal state, where there's possibility unfolding. You can choose to create that reality. Is it psychological or is it an access point, right? If you are to potentially have a belief system or credence that would suggest that you have like an access point to some form of energy or power.
That's where I'm kind of,
you know,
I mean, again, I don't know, but what makes sense to me is that reality is more than the standard academic model of proton, neutrons, quarks, Big Bang, whatever. I'm not saying those things aren't real.
Right.
But like, I don't know if you saw the news, I guess they discovered a ring of galaxies doesn't make sense, and it's making them rethink the whole, you know. So
I took astrophysics for like 3 months and I cried every day.
I don't pretend to understand it, but what I'm getting at is we look back,
as we look into space, it breaks us.
it breaks you. It's too big. It breaks your brain. Mm-hmm. But we look back at 100 years ago and we think, oh, they used to give people lobotomies and drill holes in their brains and they used to believe this and that.
Bloodletting.
And whatever. They're so silly. They're so dumb. And I think that in 50, 100 years, 200 years, they're going to look back and like, oh, they believed the Big Bang was 13 billion years ago. Actually, it was 80 billion years ago. Their whole, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We don't have it all figured out. We've never had it all figured out.
No.
We've had it all figured out is quite silly. So I believe that these things that aren't explainable in the current model, you know, the standard model, doesn't mean that those things are wrong and those people are crazy. It just means your model is not fully up to date yet and can't explain those things yet. And I would say that if you are in the headspace of, you know, whatever it is, theta wave, I forget, astral projection, you're using binaural beats or you're getting hypnotized or sleep paralysis.
Right.
Somehow your brain can access a wider range of reality in those states than a waking state. Just like you could only see a certain bandwidth of light, you can only hear a certain bandwidth of sound. For some reason, I don't understand why, it seems to me that your brain in certain states can
abstract. It's
get more. Yeah, it can get more information than you normally can. And in those states, you see weird shit. Like you saw the furry demon. I stopped astral projecting when something spoke to me in a language I didn't understand and it didn't seem nice. Didn't seem like it had my best interest in mind. And I was younger and I'm like, I don't know what I'm fucking with, but I might open some doors I can't close. So I stopped.
That was just one. That was just one.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was.
I'm a vampire now.
Like a real vampire? You can suck blood?
I mean, forever? Hey, as long as they consent. Blood test required.
Dude, if you're... If I see you online in like 20 years and you look the same age, then you're going to freak me out. I'd be like, damn, oh, she's drinking blood.
Well, I'll tell you my secret then.
I did want to get back to, I don't know if you had a chance while we were off rails. What is your favorite character development arc in a game? Like, which character you feel has the coolest growth journey, coolest arc?
That's so hard. It hurts my feelings. I was like, I was hoping that you would have forgotten that you asked me that question. Cause I'm like, man, like I feel like, cause I'm a very indecisive person and you already totally slammed it with Last of Us 2. I loved Evil Within and a lot of people didn't. Did you ever play Bioshock?
Yes.
Did you play the Bioshocks?
Yeah.
I would say in terms of character development, right, a lot of the franchises, it seems to me that even though some of them were story-based, it was a little bit more action-packed, right? It was more about the bestiary, the scare factor, right, the scare tactics, sort of like Dead Space did. And I loved Dead Space, too. God damn it. Some of the horror genre characters, like, don't actually, not just horror, but, like, a lot of the action games, right? Like, I feel like the Borderlands games and the Fallout games, like in terms of personality and character arc, you go through their story, but I was never really like attached to them. But like Bioshock, I was almost mortified by the change at the end. And I feel like I maybe should have seen it coming because it's just like, you know, those tropes and you're like, oh, no way. Like, here's the twist. Did you play Assassin's Creed Valhalla? With Eivor.
I did not play Valhalla. The last one I played was Origins, the Egypt one.
Oh, okay. I didn't play a lot of the Assassin's Creeds because I think at the time I was working at GameStop and I was working at Hot Topic.
I worked at GameStop too.
Listen, I had product knowledge because I had to make it work. Trust me, there's a lot of misogyny trying to be a girl working at, I didn't even go into that about being a girl playing games and so being bullied by boys because girls shouldn't play games and being bullied by girls because I play games. But
that all makes total sense and I believe all of that.
Oh yeah. So I didn't play a lot of the Assassin's Creeds, but I had an average of like maybe 4 hours a week, just to be able to get that product knowledge and be able to rent out games to be able to play them without paying for them. I don't know if they still do that, but I had like 3 managers get fired in a row for smuggling borrowed games out, which is terrible. Anyway,
I did take some money. For people who wanted a Wii and
like,
noticed. That was probably the shadiest thing I did at Meta.
I mean, hey, they didn't even train me on the registers. They were like, you're a pretty girl. You should tell people to play this game that we're doing on promo. And I'm like, okay. And I showed up to like one Call of Duty, like midnight release. And I was like, I'm never doing this again. Because there were these bros that kept on yelling at me. And they're like, why are you even behind the counter? You don't like, why are you even working here? Like, do you ask everyone that? Like, do you go to the grocery store and ask women why they're working?
That is weird. If I was young and at a GameStop, I would just be stoked there was a girl at all there.
Right.
And she was hot, even better.
Wow. Yeah.
That's
fuck you. Don't talk to me. But I know that I identified a lot with pretty much all the female protagonists of the games that I played. But when it came to Assassin's Creed Valhalla, for some reason, Eivor's story felt almost non-binary. And I enjoyed the fact that identifiably, right, like Eivor you can go through the story in either gender, and experience the same hardships and make the same decisions, whether they're toxic or not. Are you going to fight with your soul brother? Are you going to forgive him? And on top of that, right, the concept of not only was the Norse mythology, I want to say, very well explored, trying to make that character identifiable to the degree of the woes and the unknowns, but then also to have character flaws that you do make mistakes, right? Because there are a lot of games out there that the storyline doesn't really involve them making mistakes. The two options that you have are going to create conflict, and you don't really have a choice to be outside of that conflict too. I would say that one, Eivor specifically, right? Like the outcomes of any of his or her story still involve a lot of tragedy along the way, a lot of mistakes and a lot of bad calls. And it almost was reminiscent to like fucking Xena, warrior princess, right? Like she was so imperfect, but I grew up loving her because she was trying to, you know, redeem herself. It's for those qualities.
Overlap we have, despite you being so much younger, because I watched a shit ton of Xena.
And fucking Hercules.
Hercules and Xena, those were the two. Evan Serio and Xena. Mm-hmm. Xena and
Lucy Lawless. Lucy
Gabriella, her sidekick.
Renee O'Connor, yep, Gabrielle, yep. Yeah.
Damn, dude, good times but back in the day.
I'm going to have a tiny little shtick in terms of character development for the most recent game, Baldur's Gate 3. It won Game of the Year, right? Yes, there's mods. Yes, there's everything. I'm not necessarily like the world's most powerful spokesperson because I have been witness to very, very big fans who have finished the game again and again, who have been through the whole thing. And I'm still sort of in the middle of it. I've only experienced about half of the game. I mean, not only are there chapters, but you have a full party. And it kind of runs like the mechanics of Dungeons and Dragons, only it has a huge plot. The plot is so interlaced and interwoven that there are a lot of decisions that you can make. And so you have a Tav that's your, you know, the protagonist, the spectator, the person who you run the experience of the game through. But you also have your full party. So you have Astarion, who has become extremely popular all over different kinds of media, right? Instagram, TikTok, about how well of a character is he's fleshed out. He is a elf vampire who basically has sort of a tortured past of being a slave, like a vampire spawn slave, for years where he was tortured. And you have a Gale, who is a wizard who fell in love with a goddess and basically is being eaten alive from the inside out by magic. That was too powerful for his body to hold, so he's basically being consumed by it. You have Will, who is in the middle of, he's a warlock, but his patron is a demon who basically turns him into a demon as well. And so he has to kind of live with the decisions that he made and the path that he, you know, the deals that he had struck to become the devil that he is. You know, there's more. There's Lazelle, who is a Gith Yankee. She's a valiant fighter style who is cultured in a way of being the soldier and being strong and being valiant, but also being betrayed by her leader. And the stories go on. Karlach was forced to be a soldier in a war that she didn't want to fight. And she's a tiefling. So if you know anything about Dungeons and Dragons, right, the storylines are so thick and so immersive that your entire party throughout all of the chapters, it's all dialogue based. So you get all their stories by talking to them, and you can form bonds with them and form relationships, very, very close relationships and even romantic relationships with them as well. All of that is manipulated based on, you know, the decisions you make in the game. And it's an approval, disapproval basis with everybody who's aligned differently in your party. So in terms of like complexity and integration and repeatability, right? Not to mention the fact that you have different classes, you have different races, you have the ability of different difficulties. And then on top of that, you have capability of your character going through what's called the Dark Urge. And the Dark Urge is basically this whispering essence about you. And you don't necessarily remember your past, and you don't necessarily remember like what it is and why it's calling to you, but it is almost like a whisper of madness. It's kind of like the hiss from Control, where you grin in very strange moments of derangement, where you become murderous by default, and your character has to make decisions based on those urges. So something that's wowed me in terms of character development most recently, it would probably be that game. I have put 255 hours into the majority of the first chapter because of how the replayability.
That's why I'm scared of this game. That is scared of it.
The thing is, it's kind of open world, but obviously there's only so much you can do with like taking over the grove and, you know, but the alignment, right? You can be evil and you can side with the orcs and you can kill the tieflings, which are like these devils, right? Or vice versa, right? You can save the grove and the druids and kill all the orcs and be good, right? There's so much ambiguity to start with. When you start off on this ship, kind of have that like amnesia character of being like trying to figure out who you were, why you're there, collecting all these people, collecting all these stories, all of them simultaneously round out while your character is going through the story with them to get to Boulder's Gate. So the intricacies of each individual identifiable character having their own story and fleshing out simultaneously alongside each other is like a whole new meaning to gaming when it comes to integration and character development. So I think that that one takes the cake, and I think it definitely deserved the award that it won. So if you haven't touched it, it is a game to be played, and it is so good.
I will play it. The fear I have with that game is I'm struggling keeping up with my content output.
It's a time stopper. That's for sure.
And so, but I can play through games. Like I have to think through. So like I just played through Lords of the Fallen, but I also used to.
I've been wanting to play that.
It's good. Very hard. I think it's one of the hardest Souls-like games I've ever played. So hard that because of my content schedule, my main reason for playing through it is I like to use camera hacks and then detach the camera from the player and do like in-game cinematography. And then I do longer form.
That's badass. Cool.
I also, for my music project, I can't do it for official videos, but for social media and live, I will pull, like, when we play a live show, a lot of our visuals are shots I've pulled from Control with a camera hack where I can detach the camera and I can fly through the world. And then And then I'll put that as, like, part of our imagery. So I went through Lords of the Fallen, but I had, like, I could justify the time because I was getting footage for the podcast and Gaming Memories brand, and I'm also getting footage for my music brand. So I've just got to figure out, like, if I'm going to sink into Baldur's Gate, I have to figure out, like, how I can use that time and create some content out of it. It could be good for this other JRPG pod or RPG podcast I'm working on. Maybe we could go through Baldur's Gate. Everyone, like, the last little bit that I've talked to does nothing but rave about that game. So I play it. I'm just, when you say you're 256 hours in chapter one, I'm like, I'm afraid I would get
my close friend Maisie is responsible for that. It doesn't take 250 hours to get through chapter one. It was because of the thematics of the way that her stream is run. And in terms of character creation, we did add mods, right? We added like black dyes and new outfits, new clothing, et cetera. And so we would make themed characters and occasionally act out those characters in the world. So that's a little bit different. I did have a little bit of extra fun with that, but running through the game shouldn't necessarily take that long, especially say if you were specifically doing it on a balanced run. So there's easy, there's balanced, there's tactician, and then there's honor. And I think honor, you can't die with it character. So in terms of just doing a balanced run, it shouldn't take you more than much. Yeah, yeah. I would probably double check the gameplay in terms of if you're trying to do all completion of like every side quest and getting all the worms and everything.
Well, also sounds like I'd get lost into the lore of the world. It reminds me a little bit of like a way, way better version of Dragon Age or...
Inquisition. Yep, yeah. It's way better.
I really enjoyed kind of each character, like learning more about each character in the Inquisition in the world. I loved the twist with Solas at the end because he was my favorite character. I thought he was the coolest character. And then I'm like, he's the fucking bad guy? Damn it, you got
me. Of course.
Sly son of a
bitch. Those undertones. It's calling you out. The game's calling you out.
I just thought he was like smart and cold and calculated. I'm like, I like this guy. I like him. I'm like that. And then So I'm very, very interested in Baldur's Gate 3. I just have to be tactical about when and how I approach that game. Hearing you talk about the characters and kind of give me a rundown of each character and their background, like a wizard whose body is getting eaten out by a spell that he couldn't contain.
You actually kind of resemble Gale, to be honest.
Oh, sweet. Well, when you said that, I'm like, that's such a cool storyline for a fantasy character.
He's very humble about it too. He's just very accepting in terms of being like, yes, this is my burden to bear, sort of.
Well, it's because the choice he made, right?
Loving Mistra, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So I also like, with those type of games, I like being the character who uses the darkness. Like, I use dark power, but ultimately I'm a good guy. Like, I make some bad choices, but ultimately, like the anti-hero, because I've always felt like an anti-hero. I'm not.
You could do like an Oathbreaker Paladin or something, or like a Warlock. Like
Oathbreaker sounds like a cool name.
Oathbreaker sounds good. Yeah, if basically you're a Paladin, and so you have an oath, and then if you end up accidentally or purposefully killing somebody in the name of whatever moral you had at the time to make that choice and decision, you break your oath, and then you become the Oathbreaker. And there are different implications
as to how that
functions.
I've been called by people in the Mormon community an Oathbreaker. Literally.
There you go. I feel like you should look it up. Definitely identify with it. If you make that run and you're an Oathbreaker, you'll have to let me know.
Yeah. A couple of things I wanted to ask before we wrap up, and we could definitely do it again, especially if you finish Control.
Oh, hell yeah.
I could spend 2 hours talking about just the Hiss and how awesome of a
I'm so fascinated.
And, you know, it's not really a person. It's more like an energy or, well...
Matrix.
Very Matrix-ish. And when we were, like, earlier in the podcast, we were talking about Silent Hill and how you have to explain something enough, but also leave it ambiguous enough.
Mm-hmm.
I feel with the Hiss as that, quote, antagonist, even though it's not a person.
It's like an agency. Not a cliche agency, like a government agency. I mean, an agency, like something ambiguous that happens to have agency. It is just that how it manifests and how it is so is not
so foreign and weird. Like it's an intelligence.
Cannot be controlled yet.
But it's not like us, right? It's something so foreign and weird. That's why I love that. I love Control because it delves into this, like, this in-between realm of, like, what is going on? And it's obviously fictional, but, like, what if there was a government agency? By the way, there has been government agencies that have investigated the paranormal and come up with some...
Absolutely.
Stuff, right? This is obviously exaggerated, but I have a suspicion. I would love to meet Sam Lake and get him to open up. I think he's experienced some shit.
Oh, yeah.
He's drawing from, you know, he's exaggerating and drawing from some real-life stuff, either stuff he researched about other people or stuff he experienced himself, probably a bit of both.
Anyways. I'm excited for the rest of the game. The moment that I saw it, I was like, I hadn't encountered it yet, and people kept telling me, you know, play cyberpunk, and I'm like, I know I want to play cyberpunk, like, I am just the type. I have biomechanical tattoos, like, I am just the type that I would love cyberpunk. It's just that there are so many games to cover and there's so many games I already purchased, and most of them are horror games or communal games that, like, I don't know where I can stick it into. And then while I was looking at Cyberpunk, it was like a mutual, like, you should also check out this one, even though they're not necessarily correlated. I guess it's like the genre, sci-fi genre, that I was like, what is that? It is. It's so uncanny and it's so creepy and it's such a liminal. I'm so drawn to liminal spaces, those places for pause where you don't have everything explained to you. Yeah, it's literally like it's ambiguous on purpose. Like even just being in those spaces, similar to Assassin's Creed, right? Where you're like sort of jumping into a liminal space on purpose. But then when you had jumped back out, right, and the hiss is like overtaking her at the beginning, and she's just like, Jesse's kind of freaking out. She's like, this isn't happening. This isn't happening, you know, you know, and she's kind of panicking, whatever it is that she has inside of her. And I don't know what that is yet. The communication system that she has and whatever power, or whatever force is benevolent, obviously is keeping the stasis,
the hiss.
Within the hiss, within whatever that ambiguity is, within whatever can't be controlled, the thing that will overtake and not be defined. Definitely looking into the lore. I am reading the papers. I am picking stuff up. I'm reading it to my audience members. I'm reading it out loud to enjoy the game and make sure that I don't miss anything, because I love it. I love the mechanics. I love the fluidity. I love the breakability of your environment. I love everything so far. Love everything so far.
I would say Cyberpunk, you know, on average, I would probably recommend it more. Control is not a perfect game. I mean, they've done a lot of patches and updating. It's gotten better. It's janky in many respects. Some of the voice acting and facial, there's a lot of problems with it, but what it does so well that it's one of my top, it's in my top 10 games of all time. And it's probably one of the few games that's newer that's in my top 10, because I'm like a nostalgia junkie. I play pretty much
like those indie retro games. Yeah.
So the fact that a newer game jumped into my, and if you catch me on the right day, it might be in my top five. Catch me on the right day, it might be in my number one. Like it's right now talking about it, I'm like, maybe it's my number one. I love that game.
That's what I'm doing.
I want to play it again, because now I have a new camera cack and a better GPU and I can do ray tracing. And so of course that means I need to play Control for the fifth or sixth time.
There you go. There you go. There's your number five.
A few things I asked before that I get out. We already talked about character development. I think I have a suspicion. I know what you're going to say for this, because we communicated a little bit prior, but who is your favorite composer in gaming?
That is Akira Yamaoka, hands down. It truly is. I was so taken, I want to say, from Silent Hill 2, and then also, again, Downpour. Downpour got so much grief, and Homecoming, you know, it was like everybody was disappointed at the time that Silent Hill wasn't better, right? Like Silent Hill 2 wasn't a cult classic until after it like got forgotten about and then remembered. And then everybody's just like, hey, you remember Silent Hill and how much of an impact? Yeah. How secretly it made an impact on everyone. Yeah, that happened. But I would just like play like lo-fi beats, of either people who are inspired by or just like the video game music, the soundtrack, and just play it over and over and over and over again. And I think I love Silent Hill 3 also. But you know, you just like look up the discography on Spotify and just play the whole thing, and you can go from all of those emotions, the roller coaster of feeling that dissonant, right? That grinding metal to the beautiful voice of the singers that he incorporated in. And I don't believe that he's actually even affiliated with them any longer. I think he left before Downpour. I think the person who did some scoring for, I don't know if you call it scoring, if it's a video game, but I would say video game scoring for Dishonored did Downpour. But I believe that Yamaoka was still composing for Homecoming. And so have you ever heard like Room of Angel?
I haven't. Well, if I have heard it, I didn't know that.
He's a little boy to close your eyes. It's so beautiful. It's so haunting. It's so gut-wrenching. And I would play that over and over and over again. And, you know, I was angsty and moody and traumatized. I would say that Silent Hill, hands down, of any video game, the music that really rang to me and probably changed me in a way where, like, I was already strange, of course. I was already weird. And I just got weirder, and then I delved into the strange and I let it embrace me because I felt comfortable in that darkness, as opposed to being constantly exposed and, you know, bullied and barraged by people who I didn't want to be around. So I got comfort in reading literature, and I got comfort in kind of, you know, witnessing history, and educating myself and playing video games and being inspired and writing stories. And in terms of music, right, it's like music is more than just a feeling, correspondence of certain feelings, right? It doesn't, sad music makes people feel uncomfy sometimes, you know, just as like, you know, heavy beats, right, can get you to do your punches if you're kickboxing or what have you, right? Those motivations are different, and I don't find it very common that people find comfort in sad music. But then on the contrary, there are people hiding in the walls that absolutely have a favorite sad song or have something that they cling to that is cathartic in a way that maybe might be more intimate or private. And that's valid. But I really identified with things that were heavy and things that had weight. And I put a lot of weight into words, but music is a place where you put a lot of weight into things that don't need to have words. And Lorne did that, right? And Yamaoka did that, is that, like, you could go through an entire 5 scenes of that game, or you could be walking through something that has 0 dialogue and feel that weight. And feel that ambiance. And obviously you have the scenes that the video game gives you, but you're also kind of walking through that mist, and it gives you inner contemplations that aren't even about the game at that point. It makes you feel things. And I resonated with that so much that I took it away from the game, and I kept those soundtracks close to me, and I still listen to them. I have my whole life.
I have a feeling you're going to keep listening to them.
Hell yeah. Oh, yeah. And everything like it.
My last question, it's not every episode, but I've been doing it more often. If Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or someone came down and said, here's $100 million, you can make whatever game you want and use whatever studio you want and every director you want, what game would you make and who would you hire?
Oh, my God.
Like, if you can make your dream game, and what games would you draw inspiration from? Who and what? Where and why?
Man. Well, it would definitely be a horror game. But I feel like I have been waiting for the same mood from Silent Hill and Resident Evil. Right? You have the integrative monsters, right? You have the vulnerability. You have the psychological bits, which might not actually be very popular, right? Like, if I had all this money and it was a flop, well, shit. Be VR accessible. So it would be extra traumatizing. I think in terms of the accessibility to mods and the beauty of the game, I feel like Larian Studios would do a really good job. Not to mention the fact that they're really good at adding blood everywhere. But to have the beat be more reminiscent of darker games like Bloodborne.
Ooh, surprised we actually haven't brought up Bloodborne.
I know. There are a lot of games that we didn't mention. There are a lot of games because I think I started with like Nintendo, and then I had to go into PS2 because that was like a big era. But like, of all of the things that I finished, right? Like, with all the, I know that the Final Fantasy bit is always like Final Fantasy 7, you know, and like Dirge of Cerberus, but moving beyond that, right? Like the PS3 games with like Dead Space and Last of Us and Mirror's Edge and BioShock and Mass Effect and blah, 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 blah. I would want something integrative. Like, I loved like Witcher 3 and Bloodborne.
But you would do a third person. It would be a third
person. And I think it would be It would be both first and third person options, just like Resident Evil, because of the VR system. Okay. So it would be third person optional, but first person. And then also in terms of storyline, right, there would have to be a psychological component, because I don't think that enough games have that anymore. It's like the psychological resilience is taken for granted in a lot of games, right? You have the superpowers, you have the perseverance, you have the health meter, you don't have the vulnerability anymore. You know, obviously, like, your character can die and die again and be resurrected and die again and be resurrected. But, like, I loved the mood of Bioshock, too, with, like, the interchangeability of weapons and afflictions, almost. Almost more like afflictions.
The stim packs or something that give you the elemental powers? What are they
called? You can do, like, the hive and the... I've loved using the hive. It was so gross looking. I would want the integrative powers of Bioshock. The dark style of, like, Bloodborne. The interchangeability of point of view. The psychological component. So Resident Evil 7 and Resident Evil 8, they had these scenes, right? And what again, they're like the reaction scenes, right? But the movement of, like, the cameras changing instead of being just bird's eye, where everything was just so close up against you. I feel like the proximity of a game is sort of a component that, like, third-person games, sometimes you get lost in that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's so many things to integrate, but I know that it would be potentially either horror or sci-fi. It would have that psychological bit has to be there. And then in terms of, I know that Larian Studios would be really good, just because, like, when people integrate mods, it's like your fans can create things in the game that make the game even better without you having to use all the time and the money to keep up with those demands.
Yeah.
You know, it's like your fans can make those changes. And they can create art to integrate into the game to embellish it, because they're in favor of you. And the fact that you don't reject those modifications, it's just like that, you know, you could potentially crash your game, or you can make something beautiful out of things that you don't necessarily need to put all that time and effort into relaunching and debugging and.
You would officially support mods like Baldur's Gate or Skyrim. You would just be like, open the floodgates, let it happen.
Yeah, yeah. But it would be horror specifically. So, like, I almost would want to bring back, if I had a budget that big, man, I would stop my job to be able to write that story myself.
I asked that question because I fantasize about that a lot. You know, if I had the means and the time, what game would I make? I hope to be able to achieve that someday.
That's a really good question. I have played so many games, though. It's almost like there's too many reference points for me to really, you know, cause I obviously thematically gravitate towards horror games. And not every kind of horror game too. And especially like the moody ones. So it would probably be very dialogue heavy and it'd be very contemplative. And I really loved the versatility in some of the dialogue with both Baldur's Gate or even like reminiscent of Mass Effect, where there were so many options for you to be an asshole. Yeah, no, for you to drive conversation in a natural way expansively throughout the whole duration, you know. That takes a lot of writers.
I replayed Mass Effect Legendary Edition this last year, all three games. Games are still awesome. They're still awesome. And Alex, I went a little asshole this time around. The first time I played through all three games, I went full Paragon goody two shoes.
Of course. You gotta be the nice guy first.
I always assume, like, you get the best stuff, they're going to reward you if you're...
Exactly. Nah, see, we need a reward system where it doesn't matter if you're good or bad. Because then, yeah, no, it's rigged that if you're more heroic, you get better shit. That's fucked.
Well, I knew in hindsight, playing Mass Effect now, like, it's going to funnel you to this.
There's consequences for being evil.
Yeah.
Means you shit. Yeah. Yeah.
That's good to know. Was there anything else? Where can people, I mean, if people are going to, if they're still listening after this long conversation, where can they
survive?
Find you?
Did you survive?
Yeah. Where can they find you? Where, when, you know, what's your streaming schedule? All that.
Sure. Sure. Typically on Tuesdays, Fridays and Sundays, 6 p.m. Central Time. And hopefully you can convert, per your time zone. I generally do like 4-hour streams, and sometimes there's polls to be able to choose which game I'm playing. I have integrated some co-op stuff where I end up elsewhere on other people's channels as well as that disembodied voice. So you can look up Maisie Lin and Sass Grimoire, two Twitch channels that I have been on recently. So my username pretty much everywhere on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, which I am uploading older VODs. So my origin story is not forgotten because I think Twitch only holds about 2 weeks worth of videos, until it converts over. So then I upload them to YouTube as well. So that's GREYASDUST, gray as dust. So yeah, and I am most active on Instagram. And I can't necessarily say I've been that viral, you know, still emerging, but I know that I'm on an incline. So I would love to have any horror gurus, in my space. And there will be a Discord being, it's in development. It just doesn't exist quite yet. It's not open to the public. So, if you stay tuned on both, Instagram for sure, and my Twitch channel, those will be weekly updates to be able to let you guys know what I'm up to and, things that are being unleashed and then when the Discord's dropping.
Sweet. I'm currently trying to figure out a Discord too. So
it requires mods.
It's going to require mods. I have someone helping me a little bit. So I understand it'll be ready when it's ready.
It'll be ready when it's ready. It's got to be perfect the first time, especially with newcomers and age requirements. I think I'll be 18 plus just based on the horror content. So
that's true. I didn't even think about that. I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
But thank you so much for talking with me this long. And I do see evidences that we could be, the same person and separate bodies. Same music taste, great taste in games. And I appreciate what you're doing, by the way. Like this podcast is awesome. I am a listener, so.
I don't have a master plan. I just sort of, once in Mormonism, they call it following the spirit, which I say is a joke because there's a loaded theme within that religion. But I do think there's truth to the idea of you kind of just have to listen to the universe. And I don't know, like,
yeah,
you started chatting through music and I was like, this person just seems like someone I want to talk to. Right. You just kind of like,
you're reaching out in the ether. It was a kind of a strange and uncanny experience. And I was just like, you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb and be like, hey, like, music is great. You know, what you're doing is great. And at the same time, I was just like, just honored to be able to talk to you, to be able to network and just to be able to say hello to like-minded souls. And you can tell through the music that you listen to, through the games that you've played, through the life experience that you have, that it takes a niche to appreciate some of the things that we mutually appreciate and to create an audience out of the people that might be missing out on knowing that other people like it too. Thank you for bringing this to everybody's attention, because I know that there's going to be a ton of people, especially friends that I have now, that will enjoy it and will appreciate it, definitely.
Well, thank you. I'm going to try this year to be more consistent with the podcast. I think I only put out like 4 or 5 episodes last year because I focused on the social media content, which... And now I have help. So shout out to Ashton. This episode will be edited by our good buddy Ashton. He also edits the awesome Retro Hangover podcast. So thank you to Ashton. Hopefully I'll get more out. I have a huge backlog I need to put out. I was happy to hear you say you went back and listened to some old episodes. I do think that the format of just getting to know someone through the games makes it timeless. Like you can listen to an episode if it's 3 years old. It's not related to any current events at the time or anything, right?
I mean, most of it's like based in nostalgia and life experience. How did you encounter it? Was it a good thing? Was it a bad thing? Did you escape it? Did you use it to escape? Like, it's been with me the majority of my life, and the only time I ever squandered gaming was like the latest part of my adult life, where I was still playing some games due to surgery. So like college, I committed my full self to getting highest honors there. So I played Fallout 4 alongside college, but I did. There was a while where I didn't really touch much of anything, I don't think, besides maybe First Assault, which is a Ghost in the Shell game that actually got shut down in 2017. But yeah, and then once my father passed away, I had to deal with his estate, so I really had no time for anything but adulting. And that was till 2019. Then I met my ex-fiance, and I was integrated into a life where, you know, video games were sort of a thing that people didn't do, not even lucratively, right? And I was like, Twitch seems really cool, and I wanted to start all the way back then. And then COVID, right?
Yeah.
COVID, I was actually a vaccine distributor. And so it was a warehouse job where I was working overtime almost always. So there was really no time for anything besides my relationship, work, and sleep. So it's like that was still. And then I hit a wall.
Solid break from gaming.
I had a big wall during COVID, and I got to play Borderlands 3, Assassin's Creed Valhalla, Mad Max, and Doom. And like those were the only ones. Which sounds like a lot.
That next is one people keep telling me is slept on. It's a great open.
It's totally slept on. It's totally slept on. I played that in like almost like a sitting in maybe 2 week time. I was just sitting and playing that. It was so good. It was so good. So yeah, technically I like didn't do a full abandon. I would say like 2014 to 2018, I really took university seriously. A capstone and writing and being very, very prolific in terms of composition. So there was no time for really anything. And then once my father and my relationship and like all that adulting did a thing to me where I was in a phase of self-improvement where I was like working out and being, I don't know, trying to perpetuate my career in a job that wasn't going anywhere, that I finally got into records management instead, which is so much better because I can work at home. Then I get hit by a surgery. So then I did have downtime to be able to game again. It wasn't until after I left my relationship in 2023 that I finally got to sort of reintegrate myself into communal gaming. So like Dead by Daylight and things you could do cooperatively, even Tabletop Simulator, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre game, the Evil Dead game, which is so much fun. The Evil Dead game is slept on too.
I've heard that, and I love
so bad.
I'm not a big I gotta open myself up to multiplayer gaming. People always ask me to stream, and I did it a few times on TikTok, and I had fun, but I don't like the pressure. Like I like getting really high and getting immersed.
That's a mood. See the mood. The mood is there.
And I keep thinking, you know, occasionally I'll hop on because TikTok, I've never done Twitch, but TikTok is always bugging me to do lives and it has like a very easy. I'll just hop on occasionally when I'm in the mood. But a lot of times I sit down like I should live stream for the brand. And then I'm just like, eh.
I've done plenty of TikTok live streams. I got.
Is it just rough for you, the comments or what?
Sometimes. Yeah. Yep. But
unfortunately, the reality is
looking past it.
For women, it's rough. In general, it could just be really rough. In fact,
I've got words, but I'll save it for next time.
Well, what I will say is, I do think that you have a strong, like, genuine identity, at least online. I think you have a great balance. I can tell that you are going your own way, and I think that will resonate. And I hope you stick with it. And I think it is very possible for you to make a living doing video games in some way, shape, or form.
Thank you.
whether that's like a combination of Twitch and voice acting or, you know, of many things, or it's all Twitch or it's all voice act, whatever.
I feel the path. I do. I've embraced what I think I want most. And the two things is that I want my PhD, and I think that I would be able to earn my PhD by being able to stream and educate people. And it's sort of competitive, but like the end game is, right, the PhD, the dissertation, so I can publish and write and compose like I had been. I lost a hard drive. So that was one of my biggest traumas, is that like all of my composition of about 3 years worth of the 8 that I spent, maybe even more, was gone in a blip. So starting over, right, okay. The multimedia, I know the multimedia is like my perseverance of being like, I don't care that I don't have proof. I don't care that I don't have the portfolio as large as I wanted it to be to begin with. I do have the proof because I am the proof that the talent is there and the focus is there. And like all of the things that I had composed and all the essay that I had written about existence, about folklore, about doing my screenplays, and sort of the whole rhetoric philosophy, creative writing minor, like the whole thing is like this big useless degree where it's kind of geared towards using my voice for something, or using my writing for something, or being able to gear people towards the genre that I've been obsessing about since I was a very young girl. Being able to do that, I don't think that I have very many deterrents, and men, intimidating men on the internet are definitely not a deterrent for me. I bear my fangs and I have something to say. And most of the time it's intellectual and intellectual spaces that I would like to say it. So I'm ready and I'm happy. And even if it's not lucrative, I will still do it because it brings me happiness to express myself in such a way.
I think that's the key is, video games and music, I've never got sick of over time. And eventually it was like, well,
that's the pinnacle right there.
I just kept doing them and doing stuff around them. And then eventually it started making a little money here and there. And then I could justify the yada, yada, yada. But the key is like, I'd be doing it anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Because I can't not do it. And I can tell, I mean, the fact that you said Castlevania was like the first thing you like, it's in your blood, pun intended, right? It's, vampire, it's in your blood. You're not going to not be you, so you might as well just go all in, and wherever it takes you is wherever it takes you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a big believer in that. I mean, I know it doesn't work out for everybody, but everyone I know that's like quit their day job. I mean, I quit my day job like a decade ago. I had $600. I couldn't even make my first house payment. And I was just like, fuck it, let's do it. And it just works out. Like, I think if you're genuine, and I can tell you have a work ethic, obviously, and you know how to focus. So if you take that same level of professionalism that you applied yourself for college and when you want to get a PhD, and you apply it to pursuing Twitch, streaming, voice acting, writing for games, whatever, consistency is king. You're going to make it work. As far as dealing with the comments and the men, I don't have any. I have a hard time.
They don't thwart me, but I have heard a section. I think I've already gotten to the point where I think the worst thing that's ever been said to me is that my head belongs in a noose. That was on Alive. And I was like, I don't think you can get worse than that.
Wait,
I don't think you can go back from that, that my head belongs in a noose. Like, the only thing that was missing from the live was a noose around my neck.
Wow.
And then I have a very abusable face.
Jesus Christ. I don't even... All I know is...
Just a couple examples. Hey, you know, like, it takes some resilience. And I'm not someone who's easily frightened by threats. I'm not even enticed by them. I think that they're a waste of time. I think that the people that are going through things, it takes a person, it takes a very sad person to try to intimidate a woman online like that.
It always hurt people looking out to hurt people. I understand that. And I understand it, but I will admit, like, sometimes shit gets to me, right? I'll get 1,000 positive comments in a day, and it's that one that I'll sit around the house like, motherfucker. What is he? What the fuck? Blah, 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 right? He's so wrong. He thinks, and like, one that always gets me is people think that people always accuse me of like intentionally downgrading old game footage when I do the emulation before and afters to like make it look like a bigger difference. And I actually made a video responding to this, like walking through people showing on the screen, this is how you emulate it. This is how the setting for original resolution. This is what happens. It zooms in. I walk through the whole thing and it got like, it was like one of the first viral videos. It got like 2 or 3 million views. 99.99% of people were positive. Like, oh my, this is, it's sad that you have to explain this to people. Right. Mm-hmm. But even then there were still people just preaching to myself right now. When you said it's a waste of time, it's a waste of time. I stopped making response videos because I didn't like the headspace it was putting me in. I also realized like it is a waste of time. I already know what I'm doing is honest, and I'm just like showing people how to
play. Right. It's like, I think I learned the lesson that like trying to explain yourself to people who don't necessarily matter to you, right? If they don't, why would they make an impact if it's just as quickly like the energy not spent on that person could be energy spent on something that actually will perpetuate you in a positive way.
Yeah.
And, you know, like not everything that I output is always, you know, a positive thing, but generally it's like that resilience of being like, are you worth my time? And if the answer is generally no, then I'm not going to expend that amount of energy towards that person unless like there is a dire need for that person to be put in their place. Yeah. You know, in terms of like how viral is it? How big is it? What are they saying? Are they impacting other people? Do people agree? Are they influencing the wrong message, or am I influencing the wrong message by being reactionary to it? And it's not like, don't react to it, be the better person. It's like you don't have enough inertia to matter to me. But if you matter to other people and what you're saying is instigative and I'm a representative of that, I will need to squash you for that purpose specifically to be like, you know what? Actually, no, you need to be corrected in this light. But it's very rare that a flamer on the internet can get me into that space.
The flamers. Oh, I call them baiters. Leap bait.
Yeah. Yeah. They want attention.
They want attention. So, I wish good luck. I'm sorry that you have to.
I'm not thwarted. I'm excited. Let's go. I'm ready for my future. I'm happy. I've never been happier. I am in my 30s and like, realizing that video games can still be a part of my life and actually be an embellishment of the most positive parts of my life. And to be able to grow with them and to have them in my spaces where they are a part of catharsis and they are a part of my life and they have always been a part of me. That it, since youth, is just a part of the way that I was shaped, and it's probably part of the reason why I think the way that I do and I act the way that I do. And then I'm
100%. You are a legitimate gamer. I mean, from the day one, like that's
day one. I can't think of a day where video games weren't in my life, or at least nearby, or at least influenced something that I did, or the way that I was, or the things I gravitated towards, including literature, right? Delving into an English major, a philosophy major, right? I feel like a gamer would do that. And I did that. And even if it wasn't a useful degree, it was useful to me. And I would never change it. I loved college. I loved everything about it. And I love my life. And I'm excited for what's to come.
Well, there you have it. Gray as Dust. Please go check her out. Tuesday, Friday, Sunday, 6 p.m. Central Time. Gray as Dust. Thank you very much. See you guys.
Bye.